grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 329 of the amazing, the awesome, the Dudes and Beer podcast. Chris Jordan, your host here, coming to you live from Austin, Texas tonight. Our guest, first guest this evening, because of course, with our new rebrand coming up as the Curious Realm, everything else, we will be moving to a multi-guest format. We will be moving to a multi-hour format. So get ready for that, folks. Curious Realm, the website is already live. You can go there. The documents that we'll be talking about tonight with Mike Turber are already there. All of our knowledge vault, pretty much everything. I mean, we even have an episode player there. So you can even go and listen to things live right there on the website. See, look, if I hit refresh, you'll actively see that little embedded player start moving. Because look at that. We're live on Spreaker and our website. So make sure to stop on by, check that out. So happy to have Robert Lindsay Milne on tonight to talk about the world of the psychic intuitive counselor. We love nothing more than demystifying things on this show. And I think the world of psychic ability, I've been working on Caroline Corey and getting Caroline Corey on the show. That is one of the big reasons for rebranding the show, is I know what it's like to be to handle somebody out of an interview. So I know when I've been handled out of interviews, folks. And she has definitely been approached. And it's interesting to talk to people in the know, people like Robert, who have been using their psychic attunement for years for the help of others. And we'll be getting into not just what the world of the psychic is, what a psychic actually is, but the world of a psychic intuitive and how that leads into the world of counseling people on life skills, counseling people as life coaches, things like that. We will, of course, be getting into his website, which is robertmilne.com. While you're online checking all of that out, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast Facebook page. That is where you can find all of the news of the week that we talk about right here on this show. We've been posting some articles today. Actually, there was an American Airlines flight that was canceled after a group of 30 teens refused to wear their mask. That report out of the Daily Mail.uk. This was out of Variety. Cannes, the film festival, launched with a COVID confusion and disgusting, quote, saliva tests that require festival goers to spit in a tube. Out of fizz.org, new research shows that castration of male sheep delays the aging of DNA compared to their intact male counterparts. Very interesting study there. A wild story coming to us out of the Sun. A farmer's wife wakes up to mouse chewing on her eye in the new Aussie rodent plague. Every few years there in Aussie land, Australia, they have like a wave, kind of like locusts come and take over, you know, whenever there's that cyclic change in weather that happens with cyclones, that kind of stuff. Well, the same thing is true with rodents in Australia. And during the latest rodent plague, this farmer's wife literally woke up to a mouse eating her eye while she was asleep. Horrifying things. Stop on by. Check it out. Dudes and Beer Facebook page is where you can find all of that. While you are online, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast, dudesandbeer.com. That's where you can download the free Dudes and Beer app right there at dudesandbeer.com/app. That will take you right to it. And you can listen to the show. You can chat in questions. There's a forum there. There's a tip calculator. All kinds of stuff. All you got to do. And it's not on any platform. So don't go looking for it on the Apple market. Don't go looking for it on Android. I am hugely big on my listeners' privacy. And I refuse to put apps up on those markets as long as they are selling people's data. So stop on by. Dudesandbeer.com is where you can get the app. It is free. All you got to do is just click the install picture and you'll see it come up with a little download thing on your mobile device that then says like, hey, download this. And then you go to your downloads and you click the APK file and it installs. Super fun, super private, super great. Stop on by, check it out. Dudesandbeer.com. While you are online checking that out, make sure to stop on by our sponsor, True Hemp Science. Christopher, my God, we had Christopher Lynch on from True Hemp Science not too long ago, and he brought in some products, as he is prone to always do with me, and their new batch of CBD-19 is absolutely phenomenal. This is my daily use stuff. I have a couple other supplements from them that I use. The gummies are great. Stop on by. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Dude7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more. And in addition to that 7% off your cart of $50 or more, you will also get two edibles of your choice, either cookie or brownie. Great stuff. I want to say they are 25 milligrams each. So, yeah, fantastic. Stop on by, check it out. Dude7 is the code that you want to use. We have one more commercial coming up before our amazing guest, Robert Lindsay Milne, talking about the world of psychic intuitive counseling. That and so much more. Oh, yeah, we'll also be having Mike Turber from 5x5 News coming on after him to talk about the new Pentagon UFO report. So all that and more after this message from Podcast Cadet. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. That's right. Stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. Check that out. Full disclosure, folks, I am one of the founders of Podcast Cadet. Whole reason I started that program with my wife and branding people that I know, stuff like that, is to literally help give people the proper foundation when they start podcasts. I saw so many people getting horrible advice from the ground up, and it was like, man, if you only knew a couple of these small things that really help kind of get you moving and going in that right direction. And it's been great. It's been fantastic to help out the many, many shows that we have. So stop on by, check that out. Dudes20 is the code that you want to use to take advantage of that shameless self-promotion. Our guest this evening, psychic intuitive counselor, Robert Lindsay Milne. How are you doing today, good sir?
I am doing great, and I'm really privileged and pleased to be able to be on your show this evening. Thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely, man. Thank you so much for coming on. When our mutual friend Michelle Freed contacted me. It had been a little while, and yes. She was like, "Wow, you know, I've got this great guy that I am working with that I'd really like to get on your show." When I started looking you up and doing, I mean, typically whenever people like her or Mark Eddy get a hold of me, it's like hands down. It's like, hey, just bring me who you got. I've never had somebody from either one of those folk that was not utterly top of their game and absolutely incredible to have as a guest. But you, I've been very, very excited to have you on because the opportunities of having on somebody that works in the realm of the psychic for as long as you have. Yes. So you folks know, we're looking at over 50 years of active yes. readings conglomerate in Robert's life. We're looking at over 100,000 different psychic connections made.
That's an amazing number, you know, when I think about it myself.
That's a mind-numbing number, Robert.
Yeah, it is. It is. I hardly remember any of them, by the way. You know, and the bulk of my readings were done even before the internet was invented. Wow. So yes. So anyway, so I interrupted you when you were saying all those nice things about me.
Oh no, I mean, because it's a mind-numbing number, and believe me, while we're chatting here, I'll be crunching some numbers, and I'll give you an even better stat. Because I will find out your daily batting average.
Okay. When you say my daily batting average, what do you mean?
Well, I mean like the approximate number of daily psychic connections that you have had.
Oh, okay.
Because these are all verified connections. These are all people that have told you over the years that what you have told them has absolutely come about. That it
yes.
is the case.
And since I've been doing readings from those early days back in 1965 up until now, I have and do guarantee my readings absolutely. So that means that if I do a reading for you, if at any time from the moment I complete the reading and take your money till the end of my life or yours, and preferably the other person's, if for any reason they feel the service that I provided was not of value to them, I give them back their money, no questions asked. That's it. Now, if I did a reading for you 30 years ago and you say, hey, that reading was crap, I'll give you back 30 years ago money, not today's refund reading, right?
Right. Right. I'll give you the estimated value in today's.
Absolutely. That's right. That's right.
Great.
But yes.
Well, and, you know. Of course, yeah, that please. Kind of stuff doesn't come about from nothing, you know.
No. Well, for as long as I've been alive, and as of the 13th of this month, is 72 years. For as long as I've been alive, I've sensed and felt energy vibrations from all around me. And at a very young age, I was sensing things and I didn't understand what I was sensing, and I used to get into trouble for things that I said. I'll give you an example. I was about 5 or 6 years old, so it was either kindergarten or grade one, and I came home from school for lunch, okay. And I said to my mother, Grandma Harris died today. Well, Grandma Harris was my great-grandmother who lived in England at the time, and I lived in Toronto, and I'd only ever seen her once. And so from out of the blue, I say to my mother, Grandma Harris died today. My mother got really upset, yelled at me, and, you know, probably hit me for saying bad things. The next night at dinner, and because in the 1960s, news traveled very slowly, in the 1950s, news traveled very slowly then. So the next night at dinner, my mother said to my father, Grandma Harris died yesterday. And I thought my father was going to yell at my mother for saying bad things. But to my astonishment, they talked about it and they discussed it. And I did not understand that. And I would be at a family gathering, you know, Uncle Harold, that was not Aunt Sally. Who was that woman? Well, that one got me hit for sure. And I was, I didn't know, you know, I was a kid. Yeah. So I didn't understand why I was saying things and getting into trouble. Until one night in March of 1957, my father took me to an NHL semifinal Stanley Cup game. And it was Boston and Toronto. The series was tied 1-1. The game was tied 1-1 at the end of the third period. So remember, I'm 9 years old at this point. So when the teams came on the ice for the first overtime period, and they just kind of stretched a little bit, you know, as team athletes do. I knew number 17 with Toronto Maple Leafs was going to score. And his name was Gary Eamon, by the way. I knew it. Game hadn't started. I knew he was going to score. Anyway, the referee blows the whistle and the teams go to the bench and the starting lineups there. And by the way, Gary Eamon was not even on the starting. He was not on the starting lineup. So imagine Maple Leaf Gardens. There's 18, 20,000 people there. The referee is just about to drop the puck. The entire building is quiet. The lights get turned down. And I have this feeling that Eamon is going to score so intensely, it was as if it had already happened. So I jumped up and started yelling and screaming, and the entire building turned and looked at me and my father. And then the referee dropped the puck, the game started. My dad put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Sit down." The game started. A few minutes later, Gary Eamon jumps over the boards. And a guy named Red Kelly passes the puck to him. He tips it into the net. Toronto wins and the whole building erupts. And there I was at 9 years old, looking around, realizing that nobody else saw what I saw. And then I knew, I understood that I was seeing things differently. And it was at that point that I understood. And I also knew what I was going to do for my life. I didn't know what it was going to be called, and I didn't know exactly what it would be, but I knew I was going to be using those feelings, those instincts. And that's how I learned that I was different.
Wow. What a compelling story to know that like that happened to you at such a young age and with such profound moments.
Yes.
I was going to say, yeah. I myself am a father. I've got a 4-year-old sleeping on the other side of the wall. And just here recently, he has started with the talk of things being spooky. And I'm cool with that. We watch Scooby-Doo. He's a hip kid. he knows that it's probably Mr. Farmer down the road in a mask. Yeah. But it's one of those, I discount nothing, that a child says to me, because I expect the fact that they are looking at things in a totally different lens than I am.
Sure.
And that I'm filtering the world utterly through my 45 years of experience.
Sure. So I knew, that I had something different, and at that age, I didn't understand the value or the impact of it. It took me many, many years to realize it. But the following weekend, Toronto and Boston were playing again, and my sister and I used to get our allowance on Saturday morning we got a quarter. And for a quarter, you got into the movies. You got to see two movies, three cartoons, a cereal movie, a box of popcorn, a drink, and a bag of candies for 25 cents. That morning when I came to get my allowance, I said to my father, Boston's going to win tonight. And he said, no chance. And I said, I bet you a quarter they do. And he took my quarter away. I didn't get my allowance that day. But that Saturday night, I got two quarters. And for a couple of years, I hustled my dad. And I got so good at it, I had to let him win sometimes. I was afraid that he would catch on.
and you know, that is, of course, one of the first questions that people ask skeptically, Robert. And granted, don't get me wrong, I am a believer. I'm a believer tried and true.
There isn't anything you could say that I'll take wrong.
I'm a believer tried and true of people and abilities. I had a very, very good friend of mine. He became a very good friend, Rocky Morneau. Pass away a few years ago from Maine. And a good friend of mine was the one that called me up one day and was like, listen, I know this sounds weird, but I got this guy here with me that I've known for years and he needs to talk to you. And Rocky had been struck by lightning like twice in his life and been given the gift.
Like Garrett, that's a tough way to get it, too.
He's been in the Farmer's Almanac. He'd had it somewhat during his life, but that just kind of amplified it. And, I mean, odd things would happen. Like his knuckles would turn green as he held people in the presence of their energy. It was wild.
Okay.
This guy went on for probably about 20, 30 minutes, Robert, telling me some of the most intimate details of my life and things that had recently happened to me that, like, I hadn't even told my wife yet. And it was like, wow. And I am a believer 110%, but at the same time, I have to remain a skeptic. And it's hard. How did you deal with that in your life when you did finally come out to your family? You know, was it a skeptical, like, religious type family?
I didn't actually come out, as it were.
Okay.
I came from a badly abusive background or abused background. Mm. And when I was 14 and a half, I ran away from home and I lived on the streets in downtown Toronto. And I survived on the streets using my instincts, my intuition, my psychic ability. And I lived, you know, near an alleyway from about November to the end of April of that year. And it was right around Easter and the police caught me and took me home. And I spent time at home from April to about the following October. I turned 15. Few months later, I left home and went back down to the streets and lived on the streets again. And I had heard, oh, by the way, I was using my psychic ability to find places to sleep or where I could get something to eat or where I could work in exchange for something to eat, because I was always an ingenious, you know, ingenious kind of kid. And I used my intuitions also to protect some of the other street people around me.
As a literal spidey sense.
That's correct. And so my psychic abilities were honed in an alleyway, and they were honed for my survival. And that's when it happened, or that's when a big part, and I started deliberately doing these things. And in my time when I was on the street, whenever I was in trouble or faced with a problem, I always had the choice of using my intuitive psychic ability or doing an immoral or an illegal act. There was no right or wrong way to do it. However, dependent upon the choice I made had a lot to do with the direction my life went. And almost always, I did the honorable, the honest, the psychic, the intuitive way. You know, sometimes in a blizzard, children do things that they have to do to survive. So I had to do some of those, but not very often. So my intuitions got really sharp. I heard that if you worked at a place in Toronto at that time, it was called the Cozy Tea Room, and it was specifically set up to do tea leaf readings, tell fortunes. If you worked there doing readings, you in the afternoon, you would get a hot sandwich, or you'd get a sandwich, a cup of tea, and cookies, and you would get paid for the shift. And if you worked there at night, you'd get a hot meal, a cup of tea and cookies, and again, you'd get paid at the end of the shift. On January 17th, 1965, on a snowy day in Toronto, when it was really cold, I went to the Cozy Tea Room and applied to be a reader. And the test I had to go through was doing a reading for the woman who owned it, Mrs. Cox. And I had to do a tea leaf reading. Man, I didn't know what a tea leaf readings were. I had heard about them, and I couldn't. It looked like little blobs of gunk in the bottom of a teacup. So what I would do, and what I did, is I held the teacup in my hand in front of me, and then I just looked at the person that I was doing a reading for and spoke to them as if I was pretending I was doing a tea leaf reading when I was actually being psychic.
Yeah, and just then, doing a straight reading.
Absolutely. And then I would put the cards down on the table, and I didn't know what they meant, but I would tell I was a flamboyant kid, and I would tell a story incorporating the cards during the psychic reading. I had been there for about I applied that day and got hired, and I started working there in the afternoon, and that day I worked the afternoon shift and the evening shift. So that meant I got a sandwich and tea, and I got a hot dinner and tea, and I got paid. And the next day I had a job to do. I had a job to go to. And I worked at the Cozy Tea Room 5 days a week, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week until I was about 21 or 22. And I worked there every day. And some days I would see 35 or 40 people. Some days I would see 10, but I did it every single day. And there was no being temperamental crap. You know, someone came for a reading and you bloody well did the reading day in, day out. And I got close to my 10,000 hours by the time I was about 22. I had done thousands of readings by the time I was 21, 22 years old.
Now,
yes.
But before we dig deeper into the concept of readings, psychic, and moving forward in your career, I'd like to revisit one question that just kind of popped into my mind, because I've known a few people that kind of went down the same road that you did as far as going out, living on the street, things like that. Was that something that when you did it, were you more comfortable there? And did you for some reason almost find yourself called to being there?
Oh, that's a fabulous question.
Because the few people that I've known that did live on the street, it was one of those, like, it was a choice that they were utterly forced into. But at the same time, while they were going through it, they saw it as their own transformation.
I could have stayed at home. Okay. I could have. However, in that time period, I was devastated. I was crushed. I'd been beaten. I'd been humiliated. My self-esteem was just, you know, a mess. So I could have stayed. I didn't. And incidentally, Christopher, my mother asked me that question was it, you know, because I'd been estranged from my family for a long time. Now, I have made peace with them. I'm not particularly close, but I've made peace and I have a connection, you know, with my family. There was one time my mother, I was in my 50s, so she would have been in, she would have been a little bit older than me now. And my Mother's Day gift for her, as I painted her entire apartment, and it had been the first time in years that we spent any time alone or any extended time. And while I was painting, my mother, said to me, I was standing up the ladder and, you know, she said, Robbie, they called me Robbie. She said, Robbie, I've never asked you this before. But was it better for you to live on the street?
Yeah.
Than it was to be at home. And, you know, I turned around and I looked down and there was this little old lady, not the woman that raised me, not the woman that beat the living crap out of me, and not the woman that did all those things. It was a little old lady.
Yeah, a little human being.
A different. That's right. And I looked at her and I realized this was a very important moment. And I, you know, I put the brush down in this paint tray and I climbed down off the ladder and I went to her and I called her mother and I said, Mother, before I answer the question that you asked, I want you to know that I have been in therapy my whole life working on that very issue. And after all these years, I want you to know that I am at peace and have forgiven all that occurred. And I'm okay with what happened. But I want you to know it was better and safer for me to live on the street. And my mother groaned and she walked away. She never ever talked about anything like that ever again. So,
what a powerful moment for both of you.
And you know, I could have yelled and screamed and but I didn't feel that. You know, she was the woman that hurt me the way she did was not the woman that asked the question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, you know, I started doing therapy when I was about 16 years old, and there's never been a period in my life where I haven't been doing some type of inner work on me. There's never been a gap. It's been part of the process. Just as when I was at the tea room, or when I was leaving the tea room, I was around 21, 22. I worked really hard, but I also got into trouble a lot there. And I was, you know, kind of a, I didn't like having a boss and I didn't like it that the tea room made their living off of people like me.
Yeah. Yeah.
It bothered me a lot, and it bothered me a lot that in those days they charged $2.50 for a reading. I got a dollar, and the tea room got $1.50. Now, and there was about six or seven of us that worked there, and it used to really bother me that they were making more money with my talent than what I was. So I used to get angry. I used to get fired a lot and used to quit a lot, but Mrs. Cox would always call me and ask me to come back. So at around 21 or 22, I decided that was not what I was going to do, work at a tea room for my whole lifetime.
Yeah.
And I then made another kind of vow. And I had heard that when a young man becomes a priest, he makes a vow to say a mass every day of his life.
Yeah.
So I decided that this was my calling. This is what I was going to do. And I made a vow that I would do a psychic reading every day of my life. And I changed it a little bit that I would do a psychic reading or practice doing a psychic reading every day of my life. And I went about 30 years without missing a day of practice or doing a psychic reading. Well, yes.
I was going to say, and just to give you a little update on that number, actually, in your life, or at least since you've been doing it in 50 years, not accounting leap years, you're looking at 18,250 days.
Yeah.
You divide that into the number of connections that you've made, over 100,000, and you're looking at 5.479 per day is your average. So you've more than fulfilled that promise to the universe.
Yes. And now I went 30 years without missing a day or something like that. And then one day I decided not to practice or not to do a reading. And I just wanted to know what it was like not to do it. And after I experienced that, then I went, I did, you know, another 10 or 12 years without missing a day. And it didn't matter if I was sick, well, happy, sad, rich, poor, on the street, in a man, you know, in a penthouse, I did it every day. And I don't quite do that as much anymore, but I certainly do something six and often 7 days a week. And one of the, you know, if somebody calls me on a day that I have off or I was going to do a practice, if somebody and I answer the phone, there's a really good chance that they'll get a psychic reading that right then and there, because it's because it's better to do it for real rather than to practice it. And you know,
that was something that my buddy Kenny told me all the time about Rocky, was the fact he was like, man, I'll take Rocky to the store and I got to spend half a day, bro, because if we stop for gas and he feels something about the person on the other side of the pump, he ain't not going to tell him.
Sure. Right.
He's not going to not give them that information. And if it takes 3 hours to give him that information, like I'm going across the street and grabbing a sandwich.
Well, yeah, I understand. So for me, it's been what I do, and it's been controlled and structured, and it's been like my calling, but it's my job, and it's how I make my living, and I do keep a distance. I do keep my private life and work life separate. But I'm also always on call anyway.
Well, we've got you for a little while longer.
Sometimes I'll get involved in a project or some type of work and it'll be a 24/7 and I'll be with somebody and deal with them for hours and hours. That's happened a lot.
Yeah. And how hard is it for you? This is an honest question. Something that I'm asking for a specific reason, because I think that a lot of people coming to somebody like you, are looking for something greater than, and it can be hard to find and spot in your own life on a regular basis. Now, how hard is it for you to say no, Robert, or to say like, can I get back to you Tuesday? Can become intrusive in your personal life in that
it
way?
It has been. It has been, and sometimes it can be. However, what I also have to recognize is that I have boundaries. I'm best doing my work when I'm in control and I'm structured. And unless somebody is bleeding, or unless somebody's heart stopped beating, or they've stopped breathing, or something like that, I can say no, but I can also, but I'll also say I can see you tomorrow, or I can see you on such and such a day, and we can talk between now and then. But I need to be recharged, and if anybody is in a situation where they can't do that, can't wait a bit, then they need other kind of help than the type that I give.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would direct them to that as well.
And that's good on you to say that, because, you know, I think all too frequently, like I said,
utter true believer, but at the same time, I think a lot of people claiming to have these talents and skills sadly take advantage of people, Robert. They do not have the credos that you do. They do not have the years of testimonies that you do.
Are you asking about, I like to talk about those testimonials too, that you were just showing, I just like to get back to that about, you know, I often get asked, and in fact, I've been asked this question more in the last year since I've been guesting on podcasts. I've been asked this question more than I have had in my life, and that is about the frauds. And this is what I say about the frauds. It's been my experience. Anyone who does this work, almost everyone who does this work believes they're making a contribution and that they're giving and they're taking care of people. Almost everybody that I've met that does this work believes that. And most of them, it's true, they are. What the problem is that not everybody plays in the NBA.
That's true.
Not everybody plays, you know, in the American League or the National League.
Doesn't mean you're not a great club ball player, though.
Yeah, not everybody can be good enough to be a club ball player.
True.
So the difference is that there are a lot of people that do readings. They may not be that good at it, but they're not faking it. They're just not that good at it. Not that evolved, okay?
Well, yeah. And I think that's an important thing to state, because that is definitely one of those, like, you could have utterly chosen at any point in your childhood, Robert, while these things were happening to you, to not follow that path, to not listen to that call, to listen to family members or other people that told you, like, wow, really? You're crazy.
Well, I also was an outcast because of the choices that I made. So remember, this wasn't like last month or last year. Like somebody being a reader, a psychic. Yep. You know, that was like, you know, being an abortionist or something back then.
I was a Roman Catholic seminarian my first year in college, and I can tell you right now, personal experience, it was probably about a 60-40 mix of people that were encouraging or questioning.
Sure.
You know? Sure.
And I was an outcast in my family, after I got successful, and all of a sudden everybody became psychic. But before that time, you know, they called me the weirdo and whatever. Now the other thing is, very few people realize that they're not that good. A lot of people just don't understand that. And the other thing is that when a psychic has a bad day, instead of someone saying, gee, Robert had a bad day this day, or whoever's doing the reading, they say, oh, he's a fraud.
Yeah.
Okay.
The entire concept is a fraud.
Well, yes. Or the other one will be, that's right. Or they think it's a the entire concept, rather than so doing a reading, and you're not very good at it. So if you charge $10 or $20 or $50 or $300, and you do a lousy reading, that's not fraud. It's something else, but it's not fraud, and it's not fakery. So that's you know, what I wanted to make clear.
Sure, and that is absolute correct. Absolute correct. Now, are there absolute people out there that are charlatans?
Yes, there are.
Oh, absolutely. Good God, yes,
there are, and they're but what they are thieves.
Yes, exactly.
They would be thieves
whether they were using that hustle or something from the sting.
Indeed so. Or used cars or horses or anything, you know.
Now,
so that's right.
With that in mind, especially with the, as I hold the crystal in my hand talking, with the whole New Age movement in mind, things like that. And like you were saying, the concept of readings being everywhere. One of my favorite cities in the country is Salem, Massachusetts. And you probably cannot stray six square blocks without finding the opportunity of a reading. Now, what's the difference between psychic and intuitive?
Nothing. You know, one of the things that holds people back from developing one's instincts or one's abilities is we try to put labels on them. Oh, I'm a clairvoyant. I'm a clairsentient. I'm a clairaudient. I am, you know, and you can go through all the things and you know all the fancy words. And when you're trying to look at all the fancy words, you're missing the point. And the point is you feel, you get in touch with what you feel. Yeah. Now, you can call it anything you want. It's getting in touch with one's basic instinct. For example, I'm just going to cough here. Sorry.
No worries.
So for example, almost everybody has some psychic ability. So if we made a bell-shaped curve, at one end of the bell-shaped curve, there is one person that has absolutely zero awareness. And then at the other far end of the bell-shaped curve, there's somebody that's got 100%. Boy, would I ever like a reading from that person, unless they were all messed up. And that's another story. But there's one at that end that's 100% aware. And the rest of us fit in between. Now, have you ever been somewhere, maybe at a restaurant, and all of a sudden you look up and there is somebody looking at you? That's being psychic. Or have you ever been thinking of a friend and all that you hadn't seen in 20 years and then you bump into them or you hear from them?
Yep.
That's being psychic. That's being intuitive. That's being all of those things. And it's what every mammal on the planet can do. It is a natural instinct that all mammals have, that sensitivity. We take that and expand on it.
I'd like to explore that for 1 minute because that is something that we've talked about.
We can do that for hours.
That we've literally talked about in this show so many times is that these abilities are something that they are literally innate in us.
Almost everyone has it.
It's whether or not you're attuned to the frequency, whether or not you're taught to realize that, like, and the way I used to teach it to the junior high and high school students I taught was, you've had that feeling where you walk in a room and something is just wrong and you don't know what it is, but you got to get out of that room.
Absolutely.
Get out of the room. And I had more than one kid later come back and tell me after they got out of college, like, my God, man, like, I can't tell you how many times that saved me. But it's part of our survival instinct that comes from that.
Well, that's exactly correct. That's how we got out of the caves. That's right. With that instinct.
So with that in mind, how much do you think on the flip side of the coin that your experience of living on the street, Robert, actively honed that gift that you innately had?
Well, as I said earlier, what my skills were honed on the street, and if I didn't hone them, I would have died. So I survived by those instincts. And then after surviving with those instincts, I then continued to do them, use them to make my living. And I continued to do that my whole lifetime. And practicing every day. The other thing in it, even today at you know, doing this for 56 years, even today, every month, I take a couple of the readings that I do, and everything gets recorded, and now we're doing it video. I look at or listen to two or three readings that I've done in that month, and I listen to how I'm saying things. I'm listening to the way I'm feeling. I listen to my presentation. I make sure that I'm not getting stale. You know, between you and me, how many times do you think in my 50 plus year career I have seen someone going through a bad relationship? Like, you know, how many times do you think I've seen that?
Hey, like I said, your batting average was 5.4 per day. Right. Okay. And I gotta think it's 2.3 of that.
Or four.
Or more.
Okay. Right. So what I do is I make sure that I'm not falling into patterns, and I make sure that even though I have seen a bad marriage 50,000 times, I'm talking to that person about that person's life for the first time. And I owe that person that I owe that person that I'm going to be fresh, and I'm in his, and what I'm saying has got feeling and emotion and empathy and compassion. So I listen to how I say things and make sure that I have other ways of saying things so that I stay fresh.
Robert, I just have to ask you real quick. How can the rest of the world learn to do that, man? Because literally what's wrong. I mean, we were having this conversation before the show, and I think that if more people were intuitively inclined, let's just so say,
all right.
And that's why I'm saying intuitively, not psychically, with my air quotes up. Because I think a lot of people, whenever you say psychic, have that paranormal alarm that goes off, kind of like whenever you say UFO. And you're just talking about something that you don't know what the hell it was.
I've got other words that would go UFO rather than unidentified flying object, right? Anyway, so I used to teach a one-day workshop on how to be psychic. And I did it for close to 30 years. And in that time period, I had groups over 300 and as small as 10. And again, like everything I do in my work, I guarantee it. And I would guarantee anyone who sat in my psychic class that day, I guaranteed them that they would do psychic readings for strangers before the day was over, or they would get their money back. And over the years that I taught it, I only twice gave money back to people. Only twice did anyone ever ask. And I would take a group of strangers in the room, and within 2 hours, I would have them face-to-face, one-on-one, looking at people doing psychic readings. And it would take about 2 hours to get them doing it. And a lot of the things that I showed them was what being psychic isn't.
And let's get into that real quick. What isn't being psychic? Because I think that is one of the most important concepts that people skip over. Is what's not psychic? And it's really once again that concept of being willing to accept that there's something else, but also being willing to accept that there's this other set of circumstances as well that plays in just as much.
When you're trying to be a channeler, when you're trying to be a clairvoyant, when you're trying to be an empath, whether you're trying to be a telepath, when you're trying to do something and you got a label on it, you don't do it. So you simply just get in touch with the energies. Between about 18 or 19 years old and up to about 23, I used to participate. I participated in experiments at the Toronto Society for Psychical Research. research. And it was sponsored by a Canadian financier. And Dr. George Owen and his wife came from Oxford. Dr. Owen had a PhD in mathematics, and he came to Toronto and he headed the center. And I used to participate in psychic experiments. And there was this one time I was involved. I was doing some, and I was maybe 19 or 20, something like that. And the test was, there was a doctor that was part of the group. And one night, for the test for me, he brought a handful of blood spots on paper. What was it called? On a blotter. And I didn't know that he was he was a doctor that helped women get have their babies, and I just can't remember. The word just slips my mind right now. He was a pediatrician, so he took blood spots, put them on a blotter from his patients over a period of about a week, and you couldn't do this experiment today. But remember, this was in the mid to late 60s. So what I was to do was to hold the blotter, feel the ink spot, and feel the energy or the vibration from that. And incidentally, that technique is called psychometry. So I would hold that, and in the group with all the other people making notes, I would talk about that particular blood spot. And then when I finished that, and I did all the blood spots and people were taking notes. And then when it came time to the group got into a debate. One guy decided that all I was doing, because they were debating, was Robert being clairvoyant, was Robert being psychic, or was Robert just being telepathic? And I was listening to these people talk, and it really pissed me off. And I grabbed a couple of the blood spots, and I went over to this guy and said, "Here, let's see you just be telepathic." And I handed him the blood spot, and then he didn't say very much in the class for the rest of the night.
Well, yeah.
But it pissed me off so much, I wouldn't do it. That's it. Fine. You do it yourself. You know, you figure it out. And, you know, and so they were so determined to put a label on it, you miss doing it. Mm.
Yeah. 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 You know? I mean, you get so caught up in the definition, you miss the broad stroke of the term.
So am I a channeler? Well, maybe. Am I a clairvoyant? Yeah. Well, am I telepathic? Yeah, I'm telepathic. I do all of those things. I just simply do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because even the whole concept of the, quote, paranormal community and right, what it involves nowadays, even things like targeted individuals are part of the, quote, paranormal community. And it's like, that's totally different than something paranormal. But whenever you get into the fact of just the word paranormal, it just means outside of the norm.
I've never been involved with groups like myself. I've always been a solo act. So I missed a lot of that stuff. I've just worked by myself. And toured with my secretary and myself around the world.
Well, and
doing shows
for the next little bit. Let's get into that for a few minutes. What was it like for you to go? Were you and your talents received different ways by different audiences around the world? Did you find a specific cultural slice that was more accepting of your gift?
a lot of people were accepting but not vocal about it. Mm. And a lot of people were unaccepting of it and very vocal. There were times where radio stations where I would have a monthly appearance, a regular monthly appearance, when it came time they found out that I was negotiating my contract, there would be demonstrations at the radio station. Or there would be I would be doing a live performance with a live audience, and there was this one Christian group that stood outside the hall, inside the building, outside the hall, and chanted so loudly the group of them overrode me to prevent me from doing my work. There's been times like that.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a really pertinent question at this point in the conversation is, it's what you do, in any way, shape or form, quote, with my air quotes up again, sure, connected with the dark side, cause like, I'm one of those folks who, I'm not going to lie. I will say that I feel the vibration of crystals. Accept it, don't accept it, don't really care. I don't really care if people accept the fact that I had more than one religious experience in my life. Is what you
do. To answer your question,
yeah,
Chris.
Go ahead.
Christopher, to answer that question, is it on the dark side? Well, being psychic, being intuitive, doing all those things is neither dark or light. Mm. It's what the person is that's doing it.
And the intent behind it.
Well, that's what I mean. And the intent behind it. So if somebody is on the darker side, they'll use their skills on the dark side. If somebody is more on the lighter side, they'll use their skills that way. So it's not the skills, it's how it's used.
Which would explain why you aren't coming to me live from like your own palatial compound on the top of a mountain on your private island right now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's true. I don't. Yeah,
you
I,
know,
I just live in Toronto.
That's, of course, probably the most asked question of any psychic out there is like, okay, so why aren't you like Marty McFly, you know, and just like kicking it with Gray's Sports Almanac and knowing all the answers to all the bets and just laying bets everywhere?
Well, my work is not to make a lot of money. Now, I have done well in my life. When I was around, when I left the tea room and I was, you know, trying, I was forging out on my own, I was living again in poverty, and I made a deal with the universe, and I said, I will do this work and I will dedicate myself to this work. I must have a good quality of life or I'm not going to do it.
Sure. Sure.
And I made that arrangement. And in that time period, I have never done without. I've gone through some down times, but I always got by. I've always had a good, I've always lived well. Not opulently, I've always lived well.
Well, and that's just it. There's a difference. But there is absolutely that contingent of people that would have to... They would fault me if I didn't ask the question. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Which to me is, of course, one of those like, okay, but you got to ask the question, especially if you're going to skeptically approach any topic or be able to.
Also,
go ahead.
The question can be, isn't it wrong or evil to use your skills to make money?
Yes.
And here's my retort. So being psychic is a God-given gift. So if you use your psychic ability to make money, you lose
it.
Well, I remember, and I'll just tell you one story about that, and then I'll give you the other way of looking at it. So when I was touring, when I first started touring through Canada, I was out in Vancouver, and I was being interviewed in the newspaper, and this really tough woman, she was very masculine and, you know, hated everybody. And she was interviewing me for and writing an article. And she said to me, how long are the readings that you do? Now, back in those days, they were half an hour. They're a lot longer now. But back in those days, they were half an hour. I said, well, they're half an hour long. And she said to me, and how much do you charge? And I said, $80 for the reading. Now that seemed like a lot of money back then, and it was. But I was traveling from city to city. I had a full-time secretary. We were flying. So you know, my expenses were really high. You know, that was not all profit. You know, maybe 20 of the 80 could have been profit.
Oh,
and
sure.
That would have been before tax. So I wasn't, you know, raking in like bazillions. I was doing okay. So I say to her, I get charged $80 for a half. And she says, $80 for a half an hour? And she gets all outraged. Then she says, how come you charge $80 a half an hour? And I said, because I can't get 100.
Yeah.
And she went ballistic. And she said, she just got all sputters. And she said, you're so greedy. You're going to lose your gift. And what are you going to do when you lose your gift?
Wow.
And I said, well, first of all, I will never lose my gift. But if I did, there would be no reason for me to continue living because this is what I do.
Mm.
So that calmed her down a bit. So now that's one story. Often I'll answer the question is that, yes, it's a God-given talent. Just as somebody who is a carpenter has a skill and they use their hands, and we humans move our thumbs differently than any other animal on the planet, and that gives us our dexterity. That's a God-given talent.
Yes.
The star football player, quarterback, is using his God-given talent. And he makes millions and millions and millions of dollars.
That's right.
So they're all God-given gifts.
Yeah. And that's something that I love whenever I hear people explain it that way, because it absolutely is the fact. It is a God-given gift. It was something that you didn't ask to have this gift. You didn't perform some magical ceremony or find a bottle on the beach and read the warning inscription and rub it anyway and end up with this gift. It isn't something that you have seen as a curse or burden in your life. And believe me, I know many people who have seen such gifts as a curse or burden in their life.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And for those folks out there, those folks I'm talking about know who you are. God bless you. How do you filter, Robert? How do you keep that other world from encroaching
What do you mean the other world?
Well, I mean the rest of the world that is out there that you can always tap into with that muscular reflex of psychic activity that you have. Because sure, like you were saying, most of us are tuned in. We just don't realize it. We haven't learned to flex that muscle necessarily. But how do you keep all of that from encroaching on your time?
As I get older, I'm becoming more and more and more sensitive. Mm. And I am being more and more affected. But all my life I have been affected. Like sometimes it's difficult to be in a crowd if I'm not performing. There was this one time when I was I went to a concert, a Simply Red concert, and during the concert I knew that the singer, I guess his name was Red, and the keyboard player were pissed at one another. And I knew that they were mad, and I wasn't sure whether they hated each other or they were just having a fight that day. But the energy was so intense between them, it interfered with my appreciation of the concert.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. you're intuitive enough to realize that.
That's right, and I saw it. So it's often like that for me, where I have to ignore stuff and look the other way if I can.
Yeah, yeah, and I've explained it to people because I'm definitely a hyper aware person, and have that empathetic twinge to me.
When
I'm an audio engineer and I've been in the crowd, like, it's hard for me to go out to a bar and enjoy a show.
Or me even going to a party.
Yeah, yeah. However, you put me behind the sound booth, and you put the blinders on the horse.
Yeah.
You know, you put me in that crowd of 15,000-20,000 people milling around a convention center all day. Hey, I'm at work. My blinders are on. You put that same horse on the same street without the blinders. He may buck and kick a little bit, you know. And as I've gotten older, that's definitely become a situation with me where it's like, even over the last year with COVID, and I'd like to talk about that for just a minute, that even the psychic damage done to our society and people as individuals during this time of COVID, by either not being able to be out and do what they're supposed to do, or by the fact that they're used to being out and they can't, you know, like there's sufferers on both sides. It's interesting.
Well, I've had a good pandemic, as it were. And by the way, Toronto is has been the most locked down city in the world. Yep. We got locked down. We had a stay at home order from March 2020 until about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, now, besides doing psychic readings, I also use my psychic ability in different ways as well. There's a book written now. It's called The Perfect Predator. And it's a story about he contracted the most potent superbug on the planet, and it at the time was 100% antibiotic resistant, and that meant when you get it, you die. Now, his wife, her name is Stephanie Strathy. She is a PhD she's an epidemiologist. She is a professor at the University Southern California University. She's a professor of epidemiology, associate dean of epidemiology, and she's got like a bazillion other titles. Her husband, Tom, he is a professor of experimental psychology at the same university, and he also is an associate dean of that department. And he furthermore has a PhD in psychiatry. And they're very well-known and recognized scientists around the world. Stephanie is a client of mine, and I did a reading for her when she had just finished her PhD. Anyway, long story short, Stephanie and Tom are going away on their dream vacation. And this was in 2016. They're going to Egypt. Tom is a big guy, 6'5". And over the years, he ballooned up to a big weight, like over 300 pounds. I did a reading for him the year before, and I told him directly, I said, Tom, there is an illness in you. Now, in 2018, you're going to be more than 100 pounds lighter in weight. And that seems very clear. However, there is also an illness forming in you, and it's going to make you as sick as you possibly can be without dying. And you're going to lose 100 pounds. And then I said, it looks like it's up to you. You can either decide that losing your 100 pounds is a destiny and say, okay, and the information I've given you frightens you, and you lose 100 pounds before you get sick. You can do it that way, or you can get sick and you can lose 100 pounds. And I just said, Tom, it's up to you. You can do it the easy way or the hard way. Scared the hell out of them for a couple of days. Anyway, so a year later, they're away in Egypt. Tom comes down with the superbug while he's in Egypt. And by the way, he had this this sign and a super cyst. I don't know what the hell that is. But he had a pseudo cyst on his pancreas. Now, I didn't know what that was, but that was the sickness. And that's where the superbug came. All right, so he gets sick when he's in a pyramid. He gets dragged out. He's back at the hotel. He's unconscious. And then he gets rushed to a hospital in Cairo. And that's where he gets the superbug. And now he's really in a deep coma, and he gets medevac to Germany. Stephanie contacted me after they got to Germany, and I had a psychic link with Tom. I made a psychic link. And even though he was in a coma, I knew what was going on with him. I knew when he was in trouble. I knew when he was okay. I knew when his vital signs changed. I knew when he was in crisis. Wow. And part of the way I knew it was I knew it because this is in the book, by the way. Part of the way I knew it was I visualized a candle and a flame. And when the flame was strong, I knew Tom was okay. He wasn't going to die. And then I knew when the flame flickered, he was getting close to dying. And now he was going to, his prognosis was he was going to die. And I also had been a counselor to Stephanie, and during that period in over 8 months, I had a meeting with her every day. Yeah. And when he was in Germany and during that crisis, I said to Stephanie, in your lifetime, Stephanie, you have experienced everything that you need to know and a cure for Tom. You've got the experience, you've got the contacts, you've found things like this before, and you can do it now. And on that, she decided she was going to find the cure. And now, believe me, I am not the star of this show. There are a lot of other people around the world that got involved with this experiment. And Stephanie set out to find the cure. Now, my job, had I not been doing it on three different occasions, Tom would have died. And that's also in the book. There is this one point where I saw the candle flickering, and it looked like it was going to blow out. And Tom was cold. He was in the dark. He could hear people speaking, but he didn't understand what was going on. He was sick. He was in pain. And he was letting go. That's what was happening. He was letting go. He was going to die. And I said to Stephanie, Tom needs to see his girls, his daughters, needs to see his daughters. Yesterday would have been a good day. Today's okay. Tomorrow's sure. All right. If you wait longer, don't bother. That night, the daughters flew to Germany. And when Tom, they went direct to the hospital and they connected with Tom. And that moment, the candlelight stopped flickering and it got stronger and it brought him back. And he writes about his experience in the coma and that one. Now, he would have died had I not have been doing that work. But again, I'm not the star of the show. The real star is Stephanie and all the other people, that the scientists that were involved. Stephanie narrowed it down to three processes, and she ran this by me every day. And we had meetings every day, she and I, and she gave me feedback from what I had said the day previous. And Stephanie has one of these photogenic minds like Sheldon Cooper, you know, from The Big Bang. She's got, and every day she would play back from her brain what I had said the day previous or the week previous or whatever. And during that time, the only errors I ever made were like minor ones, like, you know, they should have used, they didn't use the right bandage or something. And I was wrong about that. But the big ones where it was life or death, I was always correct. So Stephanie presents to me, she's got these three decisions, like three cures or possibilities, and they're running out of time. So she runs them by me and she tells me the first one. She says, they're phages. And as soon as she said that, I said, that's the one. And she said, well, let me tell you about the other two. And I said, yeah, but this is the one. And she said, humor me. Listen to the other two. And I said, okay. She tells me what the other two are, and I can't remember what they were. And as soon as she did, I said, by the way, the first one, phages. And she said, why? And I said, because they're like little Pac-Man and they will attack the superbug like little Pac-Man and eat it and kill it. And she said, that's exactly what it does.
Wow.
By the way, and it was on that, after talking to like 50 scientists too, it was that that made her decide phages. Do you know what phages are, Christopher?
I know what macrophages are.
Well, phages are harvested from sewers and its excrement.
Wow.
That's what they are. And in the 1930s in Russia, they were doing all kinds of experiments where they were injecting raw stool into people that had inner bowel and colon illnesses. And the concept was the healthy bacteria will destroy the unhealthy bacteria. Huh. And there was some success in, you know, the tests were, you know, the experiments were done into the late 1930s, early 40s, and they were getting some success. And then penicillin got invented. And I guess it basically came down to, do you want a pill or do you want to have a turd? So
you know,
most people went for the pill. So that was the end of the phage therapy. Since superbugs came around, they started doing all kinds of experiments. And then phage therapy came into awareness. Tom was the first person to be human, to be treated with phages. And they didn't know whether it was going to kill him or not. But he had become so sick that if they... Anyway, he was injected with phages.
Wow.
I lived.
Yeah, and I mean, I've got Science Daily up right now talking about how poop pills capsule research paves the way for simpler C. difficile treatments. And there's all kinds of scholarly articles written about exactly what you're talking about. You know, fecal transplant pills, all kinds of things. So
that's right. And
go ahead.
It changed the way the world looked at diseases. And it changed different treatments, and it opened the door to millions of lives being saved.
Wow.
Now, as I said, I'm not a star. There were a lot of other stars. I played a minor part, but my minor part, if I wasn't doing it, Tom would have died.
Well, and that's just it, to know that you were a part of that machine. You were one of the many cogs moving.
That's right.
Toward helping him out.
That's right.
What does it take for somebody, even of your many years, because like we were showing, 50 plus years, over 100,000 connections, almost five and a half a day, almost.
Yeah.
How many of those are a case like the one mentioned in The Perfect Predator? How many?
I couldn't tell you because there
are people, of course, that are like the psychic that police departments go to. You know.
Well, I've done that. I do that too.
Sure.
I've done that as well. I don't talk about, I don't advertise that.
Yeah.
And anytime I do get involved, the agreement is that nobody knows a psychic was involved, and especially me, and I will have no contact with the family.
Yeah.
That's the agreement. And I don't get paid for that. That's free.
And things like that are good to know because, you always wonder, whenever you hear those stories, and of course, it's hard whenever families are going through that. Not to, I think that would probably be one of the greatest notes of the fact that somebody is genuinely talented in that way, is that they would offhand ask for no money doing that. I don't really know of anybody in your field doing, and I know close to a handful of people in your field doing what you do. I don't know of anybody that, if that was the overall impression they got, if they were flipping the channels on the TV or in the supermarket and good God, I'm a kid from 75. So the first thing that pops into my mind is, you know, Baby Jessica in the well. when you see a story like that, you know, and it's like, wow, I have this overwhelming feeling, and you're the one that goes to the police. You aren't exactly looking for reward.
And the police aren't exactly receptive either.
Yeah, yeah.
And
how often is that the case?
Quite often. Wow. Usually if a psychic is involved, a psychic phones up and, you know, offers information. Mm. The police don't often go to us. They don't. So there was a time. Now, by the way, in Canada, doing readings was against the law.
Yeah.
That law is the Witchcraft Act, and it was enacted in the late 1800s in Canada. And the law says that it said everyone who fraudulently, and there were, I think, four subsections, tells fortune for a consideration, cures, does healings using an occult or crafty science, accusing somebody of a crime using an occult or crafty science, I can't remember what the other one was, is punishable by a summary conviction of not more than 1 year in jail and $5,000 in cash. That came off the books in 2018.
Wow.
So up until 2018, my entire life, I could have got busted at any time, but I never did.
Now, granted, was that one of those, like, hey, you can't walk a monkey on the street on Sunday in Georgia laws?
Yeah, well, actually, the morality and the fraud squad often use that to get the fraudulent fortune tellers.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So I never had a problem with it because nobody busted me, and because I wasn't doing anything immoral.
Yeah.
Nobody
was putting stakeouts on the cozy tea house.
Absolutely. Or even when I was doing readings at the Medical Arts Building in Toronto, where my office was, at one time. So, there was one period where when I do tours, there was one city just north of Toronto. It's called Barrie, Ontario. And it was when I was going on a tour and I needed to have, my front money, I would always start with Barrie because I could drive up to Barrie, check into a motel in the morning, do a radio show an hour later, run back to the motel, answer the phone, book 10, 12 readings, do the readings, and leave the next morning. And everything was profit except for the $35 for the hotel room and my gas. One night, I was doing readings, and there was a knock at my door, and it interrupted my readings, and it was the Barrie police. And there had been a missing woman, and they had run out of leads, they'd gone cold, and they wanted me to help them, and I didn't want to do it. Besides, I was pissed because they interrupted my readings, right? And they said, if you don't help us, we won't let you do any more readings. So I said, okay, I'll help, but let me finish this evening and come back. So they came back and saw me that evening. They took me down to the police station. We looked at maps and the area. And the story goes is that this woman, this young woman, she was a nurse. She was a dedicated mother and was working part-time as a nurse, and she was staying at home raising her son. She had a nice family and stuff. Anyway, she drops her son off at the daycare. And she drives to a mall where her hairstylist is. She parks her car in the mall, and she was supposed to go to get her hair cut, and nobody saw her again. She just disappeared, and her car was still there. So the case had gone cold, and then the police asked me to help. So that night, I started looking at the maps, and I said to these guys, this would have been like maybe August, September of the year. And I said to these guys, by the way, you're not going to find her until next spring. No matter what we do, you're not going to find her until next spring. But you will find her, and what you'll see in the area is an old train trestle, and the train trestle is got carved in it 19, and it was a small number. It was like early in the century. So let's say 1921, because I forget the exact number right now. It'll come to me. Anyway, so that night we drove around outside of the town or the city of Barrie in the wilderness and stuff, and we were driving all around. And lo and behold, this is about 2 o'clock in the morning. We're driving down this dirt road, and we come across an old, unused train trestle. And there, carved in the wall, was 1921. And the police then started taking me really serious. And the next morning, they had like a bunch of guys going through the fields and stuff, and they didn't find her. But they let me do readings. And later on, several months later, I got a call from the cops that took me out in the field, and it was around April, and they had found her remains. So that was one of the times where the Witchcraft Act was used and how I dealt with it.
Wow. And, you know, to know that that was on the books as long as it was. And like I said, still definitely one of those that's like, hey, you know, like I said, you still can't walk a monkey on the sidewalk in Atlanta on a Sunday.
Right.
There are just all kinds of wild laws like that all over the place. But to know
it was
that
a strict
that was,
religious law.
Well, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, much like the laws that, came to lead to the creation of the FDA, things like that, right, out of the snake oil sales from back in the day.
Absolutely.
I can definitely see that. And at one point, especially in the late 1800s, that's something that we talk about on this show regularly, Robert, is that 100-year cycle of humanity and the fact that, like, yeah, when you're talking the late 1880s at that point, and even the 1920s, like right now, you're talking about a huge surgence at the time in the world of spiritualism, spirituality, paranormal, things like that. It was the day of the seance. It was the time that, you know, we had people like Harry Houdini out debunking folks.
Yes.
So we're right up against that right now.
Yeah, well, Houdini really wanted to prove it true.
He did.
He really wanted that.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he wanted to debunk.
No.
He wanted it to be true because he really wanted to find Rosabelle.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted that.
Yeah. And so much wanted it that he told his wife to continue the effort every year and gave her a code word.
Sure,
that's right. Up until the time of
Rosabelle.
Her death.
And it's Rosabelle.
Yeah, and I want to say even their son carried the tradition forward.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's interesting. And for me, like I said, it's one of those I will never discount because I have my experiences. I know people that have a connection with something that is greater than. And to see your experience, Robert, to see what you've done, before we head off to our next guest, before we give you your chance for shameless self-promotion before we let you
go. Right.
What do you make of the recent government UAP report here in the United States?
What is UAP?
Yeah,
what is
UAP? Unidentified aerial phenomena. It's the new government tag word for UFOs.
All right.
But what do you make of the whole recent government disclosure? What is your gut feeling as somebody tapped into the other parts of the universe?
So my focus has been giving service to people that are in trouble. And that's where I really have focused most of my awareness, psychic ability. So I haven't done a lot of I haven't been drawn to paranormal things. But my instincts would tell me that there's a good chance that there are beings that are watching us and what's going on. My belief also is that they could be other dimensions from other dimensions. But I think that we are being watched and for the most part being protected. I think they'll let us shoot each other with guns and things like that. They won't let us blow up the earth. And I think the reason for that, it was to throw part of the universe off balance, so they'll prevent that, but they'll let us, you know, throw rocks and shoot guns and things like that with each other, and they'll watch us. I also think that some of them would be horrified watching the way we behave. And I think that some that would be here would be seeing us as very unevolved, angry, vicious animals.
Absolutely. I could not concur with you more. Were they watching? Were they, as L.A. Marzulli has put forth, were they interdimensional or even ourselves from the future? What horrifying things they must be witnessing. That's really the only way you can put it. We do not seem to, as a race, treat each other well as far as humanity goes.
We have been horrible.
Yeah.
And we European, Caucasian Europeans yes. have been some of the most violent, vicious people ever to live on the planet.
Yeah.
And we're experiencing some of the results of that here in Canada recently.
Yes, you are. I'm trying to get a whole show together about that right now, Robert. If you know anybody up there connected with that movement, yes. I would love to have somebody on to talk about that, because like the literal mass graves that are being found in Canada are horrifying. And the things that people have spoken about for years and said happened, and they, no, you're a crazy person. You're crazy.
In where I live, in Toronto, there are very few Indigenous people in the area. We didn't get educated on it. What happened is when Canada was formed as a nation in 1867, they decided that with the Aboriginals, they decided that the best thing to do was destroy their culture and make them white. And they took children away from their families to these residential schools. Some kids as young as 3 years old and 4 years old, and they were taken away from their family. They were, and these residential schools were run by certain religious groups. And the children have been beaten and humiliated and murdered. And there are, I think there were like 250, maybe more, residential schools across Canada. Yes. And they've only checked the grounds of seven. Now, we haven't had these, all these have been closed for many years, but they have checked the grounds of seven. And of these seven, they have found the graves of more than 1,500 little children.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's, this is how you know it's hit the news cycle in a special way, folks. I went to put in three words into Google. Mass graves. Canada popped up first.
My.
That's how you know it's in the news cycle. Yeah. And here it is from BBC News. 751 on Mark Graves found at a residential school. And this is just,
that's just one.
That's just one of, I don't know how many reports I have posted to the Dudes and Beer group lately about this exact topic. And that's one
I'll see if I can find someone that can talk to you about it.
That would be fantastic, Christopher. Because it's a hard conversation, Robert, but it's one that we as a people have to have as humanity, period.
We have a lot to atone for
a lot of things in a lot of places, my man. We really do.
Yes.
And we got to be willing to buck up, and we got to be willing to say that, and we got to be willing to move forward and move humanity forward and move ourselves forward in the conversation and connection of humanity, even when it comes to accepting the talents of people like you, Robert.
The way I handle it, the way I make it right, and it's the way I've done it my whole lifetime, is I can't change what happened. I can't change the world. I can't end world hunger. I can't end poverty. What I can do is help the person in front of me. That I can do.
Yeah.
And that I do.
Well,
and that's what my life has been dedicated to do.
With that in mind, Robert, where can people go to get that help? Where can they go to schedule? Like I said, time for shameless self-promotion.
All right. Well, you can find me at www.robertlindsaymilne.com. That's where my website is. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram. I just learned those in the last year. Those three. And in about 2 weeks from now, my own podcast is going to be launched, and it's called My Side of the Crystal Ball. So that's what's going on with me.
excited to hear about that. Anytime Thank that you. Somebody is stepping into the world of podcasting and using that yeah. as a means by which to get their message out to a larger audience, that yeah. that's what it's about, man. You have a mission, you have a message, right. and the world can be changed through that, Robert. Thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Christopher. It's been a delight.
Well, I hope to have you on again, before we change monikers from Dudes and Beer okay. into Curious Realm, and I hope to have you on right. regularly into the future.
That would be an honor. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, you take care. We're going to go ahead and let you go for the evening Thank and you. Bring on our next guest, good friend of the show, Mike Turber. How you doing there, man?
I am doing splendiferous, sir. How are you?
Oh, doing fantastic. Oh, hold on. You're not Mitchell Gerber at all. As we say it in the industry, I just finger mash that button hard. So yeah, there you go. How have you been doing? I have been looking forward to having you on. I know that we tried contacting you. You are always like literally hip deep. I can't even say how hip deep you literally are, Moses. Like, so hip deep you're wearing scuba gear.
Oh, yeah.
On a regular basis.
Facing alligators and stuff like that. What's your scuba gear for Joe Exotic?
Like,
yeah,
man.
I've done that before.
I have known you for the last many years, and man, the last year of your life has been like, wow. Wow. What yeah. a journey to follow.
It's been bizarre with all the three main cases. Mm. That I'm kind of working on in an interesting way. I don't make any money on them or whatever, but you know, it is what it is. But, yeah, they all came to fruition this last year. Just so much stuff has happened with the shooting in Las Vegas, with key information that we have that even the FBI doesn't have. And that's
yeah.
always fun to have. They don't like me, I guess, for that reason. The Tiger King case coming up with, you know, who, yeah. The Mexican Mike guy is. And now with the Tic Tac / UFO UAP report and all these different things that are going on with that. And I just have stumbled into quite a few pieces of information that for some reason no one else has gotten a hold of. And maybe it's tenacity, maybe, you know, it's a tedious thing to stay on top of things, but it's some things just kind of fall on your lap. And for some reason,
they do.
and it's normally when you're not necessarily expecting it. It's one of those aha moments when it's something like with what I'm about to reveal tonight, which you're going to be the first person to hear this. I think I've leaked something to your show before. I can't remember what it was, but I think I gave you first crack at it.
Oh, there's been a couple things where you have yeah. come on and said it first on here, and then it came go. Out later. There's been a couple.
Because I like you so much.
I know. It's great.
I love you, man. But it's been interesting. It's been entertaining. It's been heartbreaking. It really hurts when some of these people just attack and attack and attack. You know that, but I've been there, done that, and I created a website just because of that. The BladeForms.com website was created because of a troll, and all these different things. So you just kind of like take it with a grain of salt. But sometimes you fight back because you have enough, and you just and you know you're sitting on a piece of information that's going to blow their mind. So you're like, well, let me have a little fun right now. So we had some fun tonight. So there's a lot that's happened. Of course, we can go over the UAP report first, and then I'll hold off on the juicy stuff till just after that.
Let's do that real quick. I'm going to go ahead and bring that up, which everybody, just so you know, hop on by CuriousRealm.com, our new incarnation, or you can go on by good old trusty dudesandbeer.com, go to the Knowledge Vault and Declassified Programs and Documents, and you will see the official whopping 9 pages.
That was
a rousing 9 pages of, yes, a UAP is an unidentified aerial phenomena.
Yep.
A lot of definitions of definitions, like literal, like definitions of what the word is that kind of stuff.
Exactly. It's funny. Remember when the FBI report came out for the Las Vegas shooting? We're all expecting this 1,200, 1,500 page report. And it's 2.5 pages. The same thing happened with this. I mean, you're kind of expecting maybe a list of the 144 events that they're going to talk about. That would probably be a few pages there. And they don't have to tell us all the classified stuff, but just at least tell us which case they're talking about and that they looked at this case and they came up with whatever answer. Yeah. Or they can't tell us the answer because it's classified. At least acknowledge what the cases were. Because we don't even know which one. I mean, I kind of do, but we don't know which.
There are a few that they allude to in the document where it's obvious, and it's obvious the ones that they're talking about. The Batman balloon is one of them.
I love that. That's one of my favorites right there. Yeah. That case there, because when I sat down and, because they knew it was a Batman balloon 2 years ago. This isn't like anything new. I mean, this is 2 years ago that we knew it was a Batman balloon. And so everybody's like going, Mick West this and Mick West that. And the other guy, that I can't remember the other guy's name, that they both figured it out at the same time. I didn't figure out the Batman balloon. I'm the one that figured out the other one was a shark, you know, and I'm sitting there going, okay, you got a Batman balloon. The second one is a shark, like an inflatable shark, little remote control balloon that you fly around. And the third one is still, you know, maybe Bokeh or whatever it is. But when you're sitting there looking, I said, wow, I'm thinking someone had a party. They had some helium balloons or whatever. Yeah. And somehow some wind came in and just took them away. And these guys are snapping photos with it in the back of the F-18 as they're flying around thinking this thing's doing all kinds of stuff. And it's hard to argue that one, the Batman balloon, because if anyone looks at it, it's really hard to argue it as being anything else, but people find ways to do it. And the thing is this, every time I come out and I say what something is or say what I think something is, it's like, oh, I'm taking away something from someone, or I'm a denier, or I'm a this, or I'm a that. And in reality, what people don't understand, and you know, I believe in aliens and all this other stuff. I just don't necessarily believe that they're coming here every day, you know, five times a day checking us out. But, you know, I want it so bad. You wouldn't believe. And that's probably the reason why I've got so much energy in doing this case, even though it's tedious, it's cumbersome. It's probably because I do believe. And even by my first tattoo was designed by Carl Sagan and Drake. I mean, it's right there on my arm. And people don't realize that, hey, I am a believer and I want this probably more than most. And I just want to make certain that when it is, that it really is. I don't want to put all my thoughts and stuff behind every little thing that comes out. Like the Jeremy Corbell videos. Oh my God. I mean, the last one, did you see the last one?
Yeah.
Oh, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I just want to know why something is strobing in a full-on FAA fashion.
It's like blink, blink, blink. they're following FAA regulations. Look, they don't want to come here and cause any accidents.
It's dark. Yeah.
It is. So they put on the flashing strobe. They get in the same flight paths as our aircraft. You know, that wait their
turn.
If
we do this, we'll just blend in.
Yeah, they'll. and that actually is a couple of people have actually come out and said that. It says, well, maybe they're trying to hide amongst us. I'm like, really? They have the ability to probably do all kinds of crazy things to hide from us, but they decide to go ahead and turn on some blink. You know, the air traffic control sitting there going, sir, we've got five sets of blinking lights over here. There's only supposed to be three or four. We've got two extra sets here. You know,
my favorite is still, and I've got the UAP collection challenges. This is literally like page four, middle of page four on the document, folks. Sociocultural stigmas and sensor limitations. Those are the main obstacles, sociocultural stigmas. A, I think most people, and just about any survey out there will tell you, there was one that I just posted to the Dudes and Beer group the other day, talking about how like 68% of people believe in the existence of alien life. So I don't think, and to believe that the government knows something. So yeah. Don't tell me that the sociocultural stigma outside of anything but your own military community is what has prevented this.
Yeah, I think it would be less. I think that number is actually higher than 60-some-odd percent. I think if you sat down with some people and asked them some questions, they would probably admit it. Believe it or not, I am, well, I'm an atheist, but I'm on Catholic.org. If you go to the Catholic website, they actually have a story about me and aliens and stuff like this, and they believe. I'm thinking,
oh, yeah.
You got to be cool. Really.
The head of the Vatican Astronomy Department said years ago, and the astronomical branch said years ago that it does not compete with any points of faith with the Catholic Church, that it would absolutely stand to reason that God's infinite creativity would just bound the fact
that there would be extraterrestrial
life.
With trillions of planets, literally trillions of planets, there's more planets than there are grains of sand on the earth. Literally more planets than there are grains of sand on the earth. And so with that in mind, there has to be not even using Drake's equation, just hundreds of millions of probably civilizations out there. I mean, who knows? Are they coming here? I don't know, because people don't comprehend just how big space is. The closest star is 4.2 light years away. That's Alpha Centauri and Proxima Centauri at 4.2 and 4.3 light years away. And, you know, so that's close enough. And here's what's cool. It's so funny because when I was, Jim Breslow was interviewing me, he says, do you know what the closest star is? I said, yeah, it's Proxima Centauri and Alpha Centauri 4.2 light years away. And he says, wouldn't it be neat if there was a planet that close on that star system that was Earth-like? And I looked at him and said, there is. And it stunned him. He didn't know that there's an exoplanet in that system that actually could support life in the Goldilocks zone. So, you know, and that's really cool. That means that in our lifetime, in that mine and your lifetime, as old as we are, we could possibly see something going there.
Possibly. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's not likely, but it is possible.
Well, you know, especially whenever you start getting into the technology and the patents and the science that the good doctor that you've been in touch with,
Jack Sarfati.
Yeah.
I just sent him the link to this a few minutes ago, just before this started. Apparently he put me on his email list tonight. And I think so. Everyone's got it. Like Tucker's got it. Kevin Day has it. Everybody has the link to the show tonight. So I'm sure a few people are wondering what I'm going to reveal tonight. And it's going to be a little bit of a game changer, but it also in reality, there was a conversation that I had a few months ago, and it was with Kevin Day. And Kevin Day is a friend of mine on Facebook, and he's going through quite a bit. And it kind of tugged at my heartstrings, if you want to call it that. And I just feel like he, of that group of guys, he's probably the one that really needs some answers the most. You know, I just feel it, you know. And so it made me push a little harder towards this direction to find out what some of these things that he saw on his radar screen, what they actually were. And it's hard to sit down and say 100% it's this, 100% it's that. I mean, you can take wild guesses and educated guesses, but there's a certain point where, okay, I got it now. And that I contacted him today. I told him what it was. And I was starting to say, so would you like to know what those radar blips were on your screen? And he says, yeah, as long as it's per se, because he didn't want anyone to say anything any different anymore. I guess too many people's trying to tell him it's like ultra dimensional and all kinds of weird things that it's just mind boggling to him. And, you know, he's very sensitive right now, probably to that. And I told him, no, it's very prosaic, but we'll hold that off a little bit. Let's get more into the UAP report here. What else you got on there that you want to?
Yeah, for me, the UAP report has, like we said before it ever even came out, it is probably one of the biggest points of soft disclosure that you can really point out there. And the fact that even beforehand, the term UFO denier had started being used publicly and by mainstream media, that kind of stuff.
But that term is self-contradictory. The term UFO denier, somebody called me that before and said, how can you be a UFO denier? How can you deny something that's identified?
I'm not a UFO denier. I'm just skeptical as to what we're seeing is from outside of our solar system.
Or
from outside of our Earth, period. Not that it isn't descended from technology from outside of our Earth. What have you? And that's what I've held on this conversation with you the whole time, Mike. That's what we're going to have to say.
Right.
Is that, yes, these things do exist. And yes, we have found them. And yes, we have reverse engineered some technology.
And I would never deny that at all. And what the only thing I do, and this is where I think people have a hard time, it's probably because of the way I say things. I say things and it comes out however it comes out. And you know I just blurt things out and then I look at it later and go, shit, that didn't sound right. But in reality, the thing is that I look at a case like, let's say the Tic Tac. Okay, and everyone's like, well, you can't just wipe away all the other testimony. Yes, I can, because if someone hired me and said, Turber, we're going to give you this file and we want you to tell us what this is, and they hand me a video, I'm not going to have all the witness testimony. I'm not going to have anything else. They're just going to ask me just the video. We just want you to look only at the video and tell us what the video tells you. And does this video show rapid acceleration at the end? And it doesn't. And then you go in and then you say, well, you can't discount the people's testimony. Yes, you can if your only testimony is going to be about that specific piece of evidence. And that's it. I can't get into the minds of these other people, and I can't, you know, go back and re-interview all these people back in time, back during when all this happened. But what I can do is look at their statements over time. And then go from there. And that's kind of what you have to do. That's the hard part about this is whenever you're talking about people, everything gets so personal. Everybody's like, blah, blah, blah. Well, he's a trained observer. He's a fighter pilot. He's a this, he's a that. Or what? I'm a trained observer too. I mean, are you saying that, you know, it's not that one may be more respected than the other. If you looked at a firefighter and you looked at a policeman and you said, which one's more respected today, it would probably be the firefighter. Most people say, well, the firefighter's more respected. But if you go back in time, it would be the policeman. Remember back in the 50s, policemen were everything, and they're trained observers and all sorts of stuff. So you fast forward, and today the fighter pilot is technically not a trained observer. A trained observer, just so everybody knows, is a clinician. A trained observer is a nurse. People don't realize that. So the technical definition of a trained observer is a nurse who stands there that makes sure that the doctors and everybody washes their hands, puts on their gowns, all of these different things. Believe it or not, that's what it means. But that term has transferred into other areas. And yes, a cop would be considered a trained observer because they're told that when something happens, don't get in the heat of the moment. Make certain you take, you know, pay attention to the car. Is it a sedan?
Forensic measures. Don't mess with the crime scene. Don't touch things.
And they'll show him a basketball game and see if he sees a dancing bear in the basketball game. So you've seen that test before, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
That thing's hilarious. And the first time I saw it, I'm sitting there watching it, and I'm thinking, why in the hell is there a bear in the middle of the basketball court?
Yeah.
And so they come back on, they say, okay, so, and it asks you, well, I think when it starts, it says there's a white team versus blue team or whatever. How many baskets did the white team make or whatever? And I literally said at the end, I said, who gives a crap? What's the bear doing in the middle of the basketball court? They're like, you saw the bear, damn it. And that's because whenever I look at something, I don't look at what the main thing. I know if they're playing basketball, they're going to be shooting hoops. But I know if somebody's telling me to watch something, I'm not watching it to watch basketball. I'm watching it to see the peripheral of what's going on. Yeah. And that's what, when I do it, when I train a security detail or whatever, if I train, you know, security at a building, I always tell people, I said, you know, don't pay attention to the person that came in the door who's talking loud and is at the front counter. Watch what else is going on, because while that person's doing that, some other crazy crap's probably going on in the background.
Yeah.
So, and that's what we get today. And that's what happens. We're looking at this, and a lot of people are saying a lot of things. And are they paid disinformation, or is this a psyops? Is the government just sitting back? I think the government is actually sitting there and they're going, you know what? We could put this out and not even lie and just say,
yep,
just give a little bit of fuel here and watch what happens. And it seems like they allowed the fuel to burn to say that when they said that these are official videos, people take that. And you saw what they did, you know, when they said that these are official videos. Next thing you know, DOD are real. What?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, so, you know, that was one of the things that we talked about so, so long ago with you, Mike Turber, was the Naruto run.
Yep.
And the whole idea that you realize that with this beautiful platform called Facebook that, you know, the CIA literally helped fund in their initial rounds. Like, we never did find that dude that started the uprising in Egypt that mm-hmm. led to the end of Hosni Mubarak and his regime. We never did find that ghostly dude on Facebook that started the group that said, hey, let's just go occupy the downtown square and tell Hosni to screw it.
Mr. Mubarak is a...
We never did find that dude, you know, and that was like 6-7 months after Facebook came out and became like a thing like it is today, where it was almost ubiquitous and everybody was using it, where it was like, hey, they literally just took down a government.
Well, remember, they were going to do the Naruto run. They were going to do that at Area 51.
But that's just it. If you remember what we talked about, it was the fact of what if they were using this to literally be able to just gather the data, because shortly beforehand, the FBI put out the memorandum saying that anybody with these kind of beliefs, anybody with any conspiratorial beliefs, UFOs, things like that, you are verboten by the federal government.
Yeah, you are on a list.
You are on a list. And it was like, what an easier way to get them all in one location and just
that would have been a dream for them. A dream of dreamland.
Yeah, like literally, that's the government's dreamland. And it would not be hard for them to use a social media platform to that extent. It would not be hard for them to. And I'm sorry, folks, maybe it's just the fact of I give a lot of credence to whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm.
That is not what Lou Elizondo is.
No, not at all.
Never did he come out claiming to blow a whistle. Nothing like that. And remember that, folks, because if he did, he would have come out like Edward Snowden.
Yep.
It would have been an Edward Snowden type of name. He would have had a Ben Greenwald behind him.
Well, think about this. Let's go back in time to when he was still in ATIP, okay?
Mm-hmm.
As he's in ATIP, before he decides to leave, he fills out the 1910 form, okay? The 1910 form is the government's form that you use if you want to declassify or reclassify something for whatever reason you need to do it. So in his case, he took the three videos and wanted to classify them so he could release them. And what he told the approving party was that he was planning on using the videos for a training aid, so to speak, to help categorize or identify threats, which he considered drones, and put them in certain categories, and that video would be used for that. He didn't say that he was going to take the video to the New York Times and have it blasted all over the world. And it was actually Chris Mellon that helped him out with that. And I've been talking to Chris, and, you know, as well. And the that scenario, if you basically check out these videos to yourself and then you quit and you have these videos in your possession and you have a top secret security clearance and then you give them to the New York Times, guess what should have happened to your top secret security clearance?
Should have been revoked.
Yeah, just like mine. Mine was revoked in 2009, I think. You know, so his should have been immediately pulled, and it wasn't. Wow, that's weird. I'm sitting there going, huh. So he does this. He basically does something that's, I don't want to say it's illegal, but let's just say that the way he worded things or whatever, this circle dance and this word salad that he used to get himself out is a little bit questionable. Anyone that would read this that's in the military that knows this form knows what he did was wrong because he said he was going to do and he didn't do that.
And may I just say, I have the actual form 1019 up on screen right now under clause 7, the final sentence before it goes to subsection A. Contractors may not sign this form.
Yep.
So if he was a contractor at the time, for ATIP, what have you, doesn't matter what the hell his clearance is, he couldn't sign the form that would allow that footage to get out. He wouldn't even been even legally allowed to sign it.
That's right. But look at, I think, I can't remember the block number. I think it's block number 7 or 10. One of those blocks isn't signed at all.
Yeah.
There's no signature in it at all, which basically means that form is essentially invalid.
Yeah.
I can't remember the block.
Just to look at it again, it's just one of those facts of if he couldn't sign it as a contractor, that means he was acting in a capacity higher than contractor in the ATIP program, which means he was acting on the behest of an actual agency. He was acting on the behest of some alphabet agency somewhere.
Yep.
Be it the U.S. Navy, be it the USMC, be it the FBI, CIA, NSA, FDA. Doesn't really matter. But unless he is acting in the official capacity of one of those alphabet agencies as a contractor, he could not fill out the form. So that means he was acting on full knowledge.
Yeah, and when it was in Dobser, you know, under the when it's under review, and that form is being looked at, you know, one of the key things that they have to look at is who signed off on the form from his section head, like who was over him. So if he worked, for ONI or DNI or you know all of the which was DNI, but you know if he's working for that agency or that. Whatever, then the head is supposed to sign that off for him. He can't sign it off for himself because ATIP technically was a third party. ATIP was a contractor is the way that they worded so many different things. That is why you can't FOIA actual ATIP documentation and stuff.
That's right.
Like you have, remember the executive summary that we have for the Tic Tac event. Okay.
That's right.
Most people don't realize that that is an ATIP document. It's not a federal government document. So some people are saying that document is bogus or is this or is that. No, the document is very real, and the document was written by ATIP under ONI, the Office of Naval Investigations.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was an ONI sanctioned document. It wasn't done by the DNI. It wasn't done by NSA, CIA, or anything else. It was an ONI document. And so as such, or ONI sanctioned, let me put it that way. So, and the ONI was leaving David Fravor's house the night that he was contacted about doing an article. The first article when the Tic Tac event came out was 2015.
Yeah.
And Paco was the person who called David Fravor. And as he's on the phone with him, Fravor saying, "Hey, you won't believe who just came here and who just left. It was ONI. And some ATIP organization." And that was the first time that came out. Now, I don't know if it was Lou Elizondo himself that was there at Fravor's house. I think it may have been, but Lou always speaks about his predecessor. Yeah. It very well may have been that person. I don't know. It's one of the two. Because ATIP was not a lot of people's only... Until it probably could have just been only Luke, but who knows?
Well, and the program never ended. It just got shifted to another department. It just shifted from Office of Naval Intelligence over to another department.
Yeah, and not only that, the Air Force has had ongoing since well before, I mean, what was it, Project Grudge and Sign and whatever it was before Blue Book, you know?
Yeah.
All of these different... things, and I'm not a ufologist, so I'll never claim to know a whole bunch about UFO world, but what I do know, you know, kind of goes along where you have to do a little bit of history to figure out, okay, where did this come from, and you take it back as far as you can, but I can't, this is, it's a whole other world to get into, and I can't, but in reality, there's so much that has occurred since this first started that the Air Force never stopped their cataloging of these events.
Yeah.
Up to and including what a lot of people don't realize either is if you are a commercial pilot and you want to report a UFO, you know, as you're flying along, you see something. Wow. Pilot says, holy crap, do you see that? Yeah, I saw that. Okay, well, we need to report this. Yes, you do. Who will you report to? Guess where the report goes?
U.S. Air Force.
No. It goes to Mr. Bigelow.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the good old Robert Bigelow is always great. I mean, Bigelow Aerospace is, I mean, they're one of the biggest contractors in the world of paranormal, period.
Exactly. And they're heavily into Skinwalker and all this other stuff. And if listeners, if you don't believe me, look it up. Go to the FAA website and look up how to report a UAP and then call that phone number. It will answer Bigelow Aerospace. And that's exactly what you get.
Wow.
And kind of boggles the mind a little. Now, when you start piecing all this together, that right there would be a conspiracy all on its own. You know, because it should be a function of the federal government. That's one of those functions that either A, the federal government thought so nothing of it that said, yeah, let's just give it a big low because we don't want to deal with this crap. You know, that kind of thought, or something else, something maybe, I don't know. I don't want to put any suggestions out there. It is what it is. And until I have reason to believe otherwise, I'll have to believe.
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the latest claims to come out from the witnesses, the pilots up there in the air, was that weapon systems were disabled.
Yeah, and that's a contradictory statement. And here's the problem with that. You got Chad Underwood, who clearly stated that there was no jamming cues at all in his original statement. Now he's saying different. You also have, well, you've got some people on Twitter. I can tell you this right now. This is a huge ongoing argument that we've been arguing about for 2 weeks now. Now, Alex Dietrich was the wingman for Fravor. And God, thank God she's on there because she is a breath of fresh air and she's kind of clearing some things up. She's helping us piece this together. Now, one of the big areas of contention, probably the biggest argument that was going on, was that she was saying that the event lasted all of 8 to 10 seconds. Fravor says the event lasted 5 minutes. Now, there is a joke there. If you want to say that, yeah, naturally a woman's going to think it lasted 8 to 10 seconds, and the guy's going to say it lasted 5 minutes.
Oh, come on.
But that's just a bad joke. But anyway, when you think about it, is that the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But I, listening to the story from her, I believe it's a lot closer to the 8 to 10 seconds because 5 minutes is a long, long time.
How the hell? I want to know how the hell a pilot in any U.S. aircraft would have been able to keep up with an object going 10,000 miles an hour.
Well, it wasn't doing that at the time that he was engaging it. And he actually on the radio, he says, I'm engaged. The visual, the way it happened was they were vectored to that area, by the Princeton. The Princeton took over the flight. The flight was originally, controlled by the 03. So that flight was given to the Princeton because the Princeton had it on their radar. The Princeton was using phased array radar, the new Spy 1B, upgrade radar, and all of a sudden they could see these objects where the planes flying around could not see it. Even the pilot, as he was coming up on, or the pilots, as they were coming up on the location, they didn't have a radar contact. So all of their contact was coming through the Link 16 system, which is kind of the system that where all the radars talk together so that everyone gets a clear picture of everything. And they came up on the object. They re-vectored to it. And during the vectoring, they were asked, Fravor, what is your loadout? And Fravor's like, what? What is your loadout? Basically, they're asking him, what weapons do you have? And I have an answer for that. I think that might be the right answer. One of them was previously, I thought that this was actual U.S. technology. And that was based on the evidence that I had up to the time. And now it's a little different. But when they were asking that, they know he's in a training ADEX situation. So he's in a training situation. He doesn't have any live weapons. But maybe the person that's the radar controller didn't know for real. And maybe someone had some live ordnance or something. But anyway, so they asked him that. And he says no. And they say, okay, well, continue on. Like, wait a second, you just asked me if I have weapons, and you're vectoring towards some object, and I tell you no when you say, well, continue on.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Well, that's just it. Number one, that was something that we've called into question the whole time. Even if you are out on standard maneuvers, if you're out on standard maneuvers, you would be armed. Because you're out on maneuver.
Yeah. And
in addition to that, nobody was scrambled to escort them. They were just told to observe.
Yeah, and they could have if they would have thought this was a legitimate thing. And I do have the answer to this based on some more information that I have now. Because now I feel a little bit better about it. They didn't scramble someone from Miramar or from any of the other bases that were nearby.
Yeah,
because the objects did not appear to be a threat. Kevin Day, who saw these objects on the screen for several days. Now, we're done. See, a lot of people think the Tic Tac event was a one-day, one-time event. They even believe the video is from Fravor, because if people don't study this a little bit, they don't know. But this was happening from around November 10th all the way through the 16th.
Their whole time of maneuvers.
Yeah. Well, there are times the maneuvers was even longer than that. I think it was still the 21st, 22nd. But the time that they saw these objects was primarily from the 10th to the 16th.
Mm.
And so these objects were tracking down and what have you. But back to the Fravor situation, when they happened on the Tic Tac, as he looked down, his statement was that it was hovering and it was Harrier-like, meaning it was just sitting there. Then in another statement, he stated that the object looked like a ping pong bouncing back and forth. Okay. Alex's statement, Alex Dietrich, she's the wingman. Her statement was it was traveling in a straight line between 300 and 500 knots. Her WSO, the WSO officer behind her, said that it was traveling relatively straight and or level and was about 300 knots. Those are contradictory statements.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like one was saying they're going 300 knots and the other was saying it's going 400 or 500 knots.
I mean, different statements from the same cockpit.
Yeah, exactly. So, and if someone was saying just different speed variance or maybe a slight direction variance, but you're talking about one person saying it looked like a ping pong ball bouncing back and forth.
Yeah.
And I have a partial answer to that. And then another one saying that it was traveling a straight line across. So there's some questions about who saw what when and what was the object doing at the time that they saw it, or was there possibly more than one object, which is very possible, where one saw one going in a straight line and was fixated on that while the other one was seeing the one doing the ping pong ball dance and was fixated on that. They may have been looking at two different objects and one was fixated on one and one was fixated on another.
Sure.
That's another possibility, but it's not as accepted because no one's really brought that to the surface yet. But, so you have him. Here's what I surmise happened. They saw an object that was possibly underwater. They saw the water was frothing up and stuff like that, about the size of a 737, something under the water, and even the shape of possibly a plane. So they thought a plane may have crashed and had just sunk underneath the water, or possibly a submarine was going down. So as you look at that, and the object above the water, the Tic Tac, was sitting there bouncing back and forth. Visualize this. You have a submarine that's launching a balloon. They launch a balloon through a canister. The canister goes to the surface, opens up, and then the balloon comes out, and the balloon starts to inflate. As it inflates, it goes up to about 50 feet or so. They turn on the instrumentation that's still tethered to the submarine, and then they release it. As that balloon is tethered to the submarine, it's kind of bouncing around a little bit. Fravor said one thing that was a key piece of evidence. He said that the object was in a north-south direction. It would ping-pong around, but it always maintained that north-south direction. Well, the wind was coming from the north that day. And so a balloon tethered in the wind is going to look like a windsock, so to speak, and it's going to take that direction. So that kind of makes sense. Okay. When it was released, as he started down, let's just assume it's a balloon for a moment, just for shits and giggles. We'll just say, okay, let's pretend it's a balloon for a minute. As the balloon drifts up, it starts to go up in a slow arc. Everyone's launched a balloon before. They don't just go straight up. They kind of meander with the wind. And sometimes they'll go in a long arc or whatever. So maybe the balloon came up and it started going in an arc. Well, he saw this as it starting to trail him or starting to mimic his moves. As he's circling down, it's circling up. And as he sees this, he's thinking it's a bigger object than it is. And he cuts that circle in half. And as he cuts the circle in half, the object's closer than he thought, and it just zooms right by his left shoulder, boom, goes over the top, or maybe he even bursts the thing as he hits it, and it disappears.
Yeah.
Now, on the CBS show, he said it disappeared, but on one of the other statements, he said it was, you know, it went off on the horizon. The Wizzo, Alice's Wizzo, said that it was like it was shot out of a rifle towards the horizon. I would prefer to believe that it went to the horizon and was going super fast. That would be really cool. But what makes more sense to me is that he probably disrupted it so much that it burst and then just went down to the water. No one saw it again because it was smaller at that point. And then that was the end of that. And he took off. That was the end. And the next thing you know, it's at the cap point. And they're thinking it's the same one. Well, that brings in DRFM technology, and that's a whole nother show.
Well, and I've got the article up from Sun right now talking about the crew aboard the Ticonderoga class guided missile cruiser USS Princeton had been spending the last 2 weeks tracking mysterious aircraft on and off with an advanced AN Spy-1B passive radar. And it goes into Mr. Underwood's, which being a Fletch fan just makes me think of a horribly thought up, you know, fake name. But revealed that his weapon system was suddenly crippled after he attempted to track the Tic Tac object. Once I got on the target of interest on my radar and took a lock, that's when the kind of funky things started happening. And it's one of those, if that happened, once again, do you think that they wouldn't scramble assistance?
Well, technically, that would be an act of war.
Yeah.
If an object enters airspace, but here's the problem. Chad could not determine that the jamming, if there was jamming, was coming from that object because the object was far away and the object was technically moving away from him. So, but there was another aircraft that was in the air, in the area, that actually was jamming things, and that was a F-18 Growler. So that is, for me, that would be more likely scenario because they were playing red team, blue team scenarios. Yeah. And the Growler was putting out jamming signals and saying, okay, guys, I'm jamming there. You guys figure out where everybody's at and go at it. You know, and that to me is more believable than the other aircraft, which they call the Tic Tac. Now keep in mind this, the object that Fravor saw and the object that Chad Underwood saw, I believe, are two completely different objects because the shape's different, everything.
Oh, yeah.
And I have the video. I don't know if you saw the video or not, but I zoomed in on the video, kind of cleaned it up a little bit, and then I compared it to another video. It took me, I went to 100 videos trying to find another FLIR video of an object at a distance that looked about the same. And then finally, David Fouts, it was a expert in FLIR, came out with a video showing an F-18 banking to the left, not at a great distance, so the video is more clear. but it looked virtually identical. And I said, oh my God.
Yeah.
We're thinking this thing's a Tic Tac, and it's actually an F-18 making a small left banking turn to the, or banking turn to the left. And it looks just like it. Granted, it's a little fuzzy, so I can't say 100%, but it sure is.
That's just it, though. If you're moving at the same relative speed and at the same relative angle as them, as they're performing that hard left banking continuous turn, it will seem like that object is hovering straight up.
Yeah. Right. And even
like,
so,
that's
even,
just physics even, of the observer.
Right. And you can see the object's moving. Now, see, the thing is that not one of the videos shows any of the objects doing anything extraordinary. Not one.
Yeah.
And so as we watch these things, people say, well, the Tic Tac at the end of the video darted off to the left at like 10,000 miles an hour. No, it didn't. it really didn't. It takes a little bit to explain, but that's another thing. But it literally just the at FLIR lost lock, and the object moved off to the left at the exact same speed that it moved off to the left when it lost lock the two or three times previous to that.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same thing. So, you know, it really bothers me to some degree that this video has been out this long and it has so many different interpretations as to what that object was doing. I would love to sit here and say, yeah, the object went off at 10,000 miles an hour and it did all these different things. I can't say that because it just didn't do it.
We had more investigation into the video of what happened with the Challenger.
Yeah.
Than what we have with this.
And technically, this would be considered, sadly enough, a more important story.
Now, granted, like I've said in every single episode covering this, I am not saying that this report put out by the United States government is not huge. It's huge.
Yeah.
It's amazing news for them even to admit the fact that they have had programs fully researching into this. And for them to say, hey, contractors, we're going to hold you accountable. We want to know what you know, at least to a couple of them. yeah, absolutely. Are they going to get things from crazy black projects, other deep research programs? Hell no. They aren't getting
that. Here's something that's truly...
Even the people sitting on those panels are not on a need-to-know basis.
Right, exactly. And you know, you only have to have a top secret security clearance. All you have to do is sit there and somebody say something, and you're on the on with NTK. So you're sitting there going, "I'm listening to some very highly classified material here." Oh, okay, well, you're on a need to know basis. Get your butt in here and listen. Bypassing the entire security clearance protocol. I mean, that does happen. I know for a fact it does because it happened to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things do occur. But the thing about the report, look at it this way. There's 144 reports.
Yeah.
I don't want to take away from the UAP task force or say that they're inept or they're incompetent or whatever.
No, absolutely not.
But out of 144, they were able to figure out one. That is concerning for me, but I don't know all 140. I know what some of them are. I did see a screenshot or two, but of the ones that I know that they looked at that have already, I don't want to use the word debunked, but have been solved. I'm curious as to why they couldn't figure those out based on the fact that pretty plausible explanations for these events have occurred. And you can pretty much accept them or peer review it and check it yourself and say, well, you know what? He's right. And Mick West would be the one that would be probably the tops on all the debunkers in that category, as he's done a lot of work. You know, I've peer reviewed him several times and I can't argue with some of the things he comes up with. There's some things that's a little stretched, but you know, but for the most part, I can't argue with it. He's not a scientist. He's not a mathematician. He's not a physicist. He's not a this or that. Neither am I. And when you have people like Eric Davis who argued with me and said that your math is wrong, but he couldn't show me where the math comes wrong. Tim McMillan did the same thing. And Tim McMillan ran off, said, I'm going to get that $10,000 from Turber. Yay. And he goes running off and then hasn't been seen or heard from since.
You still got a stack of cash.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's there if anyone can do it.
Well, you know, with that in mind, as
we get ready to let you go here, Mike. Like, yeah. It's...
I gotta give you the leak. I gotta leak the stuff to you.
Well, leak it.
Here we go. Okay. The big mystery of the objects that Kevin Day was tracking, if you remember correctly, he said that they were dropping in from either space or from very high up, because the radar surface is like maybe 60,000 feet, maybe 80,000 feet is as high as that phased array radar is going to track. Anything beyond that, you're getting into ballistic missile territory. Yeah. So the ballistic missile guys actually did track these things coming down from a very high altitude. Okay, well, that's great. And as soon as they came in, they would drop to about 28,000 feet, and they started moving across the screen at 120 knots. Well, one of the key pieces of information that I didn't have until today was I never asked Kevin how far apart were these objects. The reason why I asked him that today was because the information that I got was this. At the same time that they were having these sightings of these objects that were coming in, from November 10th to November 16th, the Air Force was preparing to launch the X-43 hypervelocity missile. Okay, so this hyper missile was going to go Mach 9.6 and was released on November 16th. The week preceding the X-43 launch, they launched a ridiculous amount of weather balloons, somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 100 and some odd weather balloons, which happens to match almost exactly how many tracks that he said he had. So these balloons, which everybody hates, oh, God, it's another balloon. These skeptics can't get away from balloons. Yeah, well, unfortunately, we launch a lot of balloons. There's two balloons per location launched per day, and there's 900 locations that launches weather balloons every day at 12 noon and 12 midnight London time. So take those balloons into consideration, and then add in the fact that they were launching 4 to 10 balloons per day so that they could track that weather and the wind speeds at various altitudes over the location. Here's where the balloons came from. This is what I got today. The balloons were launched from Point Magoo, also from San Nicolas Island, and also Vandenberg. So you had three locations that these balloons were launched. Some were launched 4 and 6 at a time. The locations, once the balloons were launched, these balloons would kind of follow into the air patterns that were over that area, and they were tracking south at, guess what, 100 knots.
Hmm.
Exactly the same speed and altitudes that were mentioned by Kevin Day. These balloons have about a 2-hour life. And if you look at how far they went, and if you measure it out on a map, you'll see the balloons go up. They get up to about 100,000 feet or so, or whatever. They have that pattern because the X-43 was launched at 24,000 feet and had a trajectory that would take it up to 95,000 feet. And it was launched. It came over from Edwards, went off to the training area range, which is just north of San Nicolas Island. So they measured these upper level wind speeds by these balloons. And these balloons would go up, and they could change the altitude. They're called boundary layer pressurized balloons or high pressurized balloons, where they can actually change the altitude. So they can measure the air at, say, 20,000 feet, then they can go up to 30,000 feet and hover on that altitude for a certain period of time, or have the balloons at various altitudes all at the same time. And then at some point in time, they're like, okay, the useful life of the balloon is over, and ditch them. And guess where they ditched them? All over towards Guadalupe. That's exactly where Kevin Day said that the balloons in, or not, he didn't say the balloons. He says these objects seemed to track south, and as they came back down and they were dropping out of the sky, and they would hit 28,000 feet, they'd track in about 100 knots, and then we would lose them over Guadalupe.
Yeah.
That's exactly what these balloons, that's exactly how far the balloons
are. I've got the NASA X-43 information up right now, at least some Wikipedia stuff. And the last paragraph is talking about the first plane in the series, the X-43A, was the single use, of which three were built. The first X-43A was destroyed after malfunctioning in flight in 2001. Yep. Now note, people, 2001. Yep. We had experimental hypersonic technology, things going Mach 9.6.
Yep. And look at the date.
Each of the other two flew successfully in 2004.
Yep.
Setting speed records.
Yep. And the one on November 16th was the one that went 9.6 right off the coast of California. Same spot, same time, and exactly from the 10th to the 16th is the dates that they launched the balloons, and that's the exact same dates that they were seeing these objects. I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure this one out.
Setting speed records with the scramjets operating for approximately 10 seconds.
Yep. And went 17 miles in 10 seconds.
Followed by 10-minute glides and intentional crashes into the ocean.
Yep. They dished right in the ocean. And that was built by I think the company's called Microcraft. I think they're from Tennessee. And I mean, it's built by a contractor. It wasn't, you know, Air Force thing built. You know, all it takes for someone to do
airframe by Microcraft.
And anyone can check anything that I'm saying. The I even have the name of the woman that lost the balloons. I mean, I'll just say her first name is Barbara. So,
GASL, you know, General Applied Science Laboratory, made the engine.
Yep, exactly. And so this technology, now you can make a essentially a pulse scramjet in your house.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever done that with a mason jar?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah, they're great. Yep. The little just, you know, like they have crazy sounds. It's wild.
And they're loud. They're loud as hell.
Very loud, very powerful stuff. Like you can make them with 2-liter bottles. It's crazy. But... yeah, I mean, people once again forget the fact that technology like this exists. And the only way to test it is to put it out against that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Is to like we've said, red team it, to put it out against the passive radar systems and see how it's, because a passive radar system is the only way you're going to be able to intercept a hypersonic missile.
That's correct.
The chances, by the time your radar dish swings back around, you've been hit.
Yeah, in 12 seconds. 12 seconds. The most radars flip around 12 seconds. So 12 seconds, you're dead.
You're dead. Between the radar sweeps, you've been killed. It wasn't there, and then it was there. By the time the radar went away and came back, it was there and gone. Like, literally, you know? So, yeah. And we've said it before, that is the only way that we are going to be able to say, like, this technology exists. This stuff is out there. Like, to know that, like, how many years ago was it that we were talking about the hypersonic race against Russia and China?
Oh, yeah, that was, remember, part of one of the original XPRIZES was one of those. And we wouldn't let Russia enter. It's like, wait a second.
Yeah.
There's no rules against what country. The Jamaican bobsled team come in.
Come in and hand it to you. Well, the problem is they'd be disallowed. At least if they're proper rosters. Anyway, Mike, man, thank you so much. I like this new information. Looking at this in new light, once again, just brings to fact that people, please don't just swallow the lure.
Yeah, don't even swallow mine. Please check me out. Check that information out. You'll see.
The lure is bright, shiny. It makes cool noises. You know, it's supposed to replicate something that's real. And that's the thing is that, yes, we have had technology. Yes, these things have existed. Like they've said in the report, they've been researching it for years. Programs like ATIP existed for a reason. They were being looked into for a reason. To say otherwise is foolishness.
Right.
At least at this point.
There's still an awful lot that we don't know. An awful lot I don't know. I don't have all the answers. I'm just trying to figure out pieces of a puzzle that I'm personally involved in because of the phone call I got in 2005.
Hey.
And that is it. It's been an itch of mine. I've been scratching it. Look, I want to figure out what this thing is. And I've been asked a couple questions on some other objects or whatever, but I'm not going to like try to come into the UFO world and try to take over. That's not my goal. I'm going to answer the questions that I feel are important at this time and then move on, you know, and do what I do. But, I think this is
all you're doing is presenting new information. And I consider the new information that you bring in
nothing more than confirmation of the hypotheses that I have been putting forth about this stuff since day one. That I have been putting forth. I've even been putting forth these hypotheses about Lou Elizondo. I'd love to meet Lou Elizondo.
Oh,
but I'd have some questions.
You know who you need on your show is Jack Sarfati.
I would love to have Tic Tac Jack on. If you can get Tic Tac Jack on the show, I'll send you a bottle of Red Label by like Faber or something, bro.
Because he'll tell you how this stuff works, and he'll tell you how this stuff works in a way that we could do it possibly even now if we had the engineering skills to do it, to pull off the metamaterial.
His appearance on Deep Space on Gaia, incredible.
Yeah.
Yep. Really, really lays it out and lays out the technology that we've talked about for a long time, where it's basically pulling and pushing at the same time, like pushing your way through time. Very, very interesting, very, very absolutely doable through proper forces of electromagnetics. So, I'd love to have him on if you can get that going.
I'll send him the note, and because I'll probably talk to him, or not talk to him, but I'll send him an email after this, because he's already brought up the Kevin Day thing. We're on an email list of a bunch of people, and so I'll try to get you on that list, because there's a lot of interesting conversation that you'd probably like.
I'll bet. And my thing is, there's only when somebody gets hit with a hypersonic missile, then people will remember, like, oh yeah, that shit exists. But the problem is, they're even going to have to explain where the technology for hypersonic missiles came from and how the hell they've been working on that technology and that kind of propulsion for the last 20 years, unbeknownst to anybody publicly.
Wait until you see the sled that I'm going to upload tonight. There's a Holloman Air Force Base. They had a sled that went hypersonic on the ground.
Wow.
I think it's 6,500. It's either 8,599 or 6,599 miles an hour.
Well,
on the
ground. Wouldn't doubt it. I mean, you go to somewhere like JPL, everything else. That's where that's where all the testing goes on rail systems, things like that, where they've got like quarter mile tracks of rails set up and they just fire off a rocket and clock it, you know? Yep.
I'm gonna upload that video here in just a second. It's pretty interesting. I mean, literally, the camera's right close to the track, and the object goes by.
I'm sure
so
it just destroys the camera.
No, it didn't, which was kind of cool. I wish they would have filmed it with a very high speed camera. It seems like they filmed it with a normal speed camera, but so I had to slow it down myself down to where you could even tell what happened. I mean, it's like, pew, and you're like, what the hell just happened? Yeah. They slowed it down to maybe, a tenth of a speed or whatever. I slowed it down even further than that, but so you can at least tell what's going on. But yeah, that was pretty interesting. So I'm going to put that up here in a bit.
Yeah, and that's just it. Like I've said, everything that we've seen, it is full soft disclosure, full on.
Yeah.
And when I say soft disclosure, it's disclosure for a purpose, disclosure for a reason. It's the only way. Whenever you see reports from vice.com and things like that. I mean, hell, they just released that one of the big super colliders has a magnet powerful enough to lift a super carrier.
Yep.
That's crazy. Yep. That's crazy.
And even Florida State University, I used to go down. I'm so just enamored by magnets. I have magnets all the time. I mean, super powerful magnets. And you probably have some of the ridiculous neodymiums like N50 or whatever.
Yeah.
And like the size of the palm of your hand. Well, you know as well as I do, if you have two of those anywhere near each other, you're probably going to have a hard time.
Dude,
it's gonna hurt.
You saw my little rig that I had with the copper tube and copper wire and all that. Actively magnetized copper.
Really?
At one point.
What?
Like the copper became magnetic. It did not stay for long.
But isn't that a wild thing?
Between the electric forces I was pumping through it and the magnet power that I had around it, that copper became magnetic for like 30 seconds. And it was like, wow.
How'd that happen?
I just did that in my home studio. I did that.
Yeah. Isn't that funny? You and I had, it was funny when you were sending me pictures one time of something you were working on. I was like, wait a second. And then even to the,
when I was working on that. Remember when you came here and I showed you my clock that looked like it was the Predator's timekeeper because it had just been destroyed by the RF field? Yeah. Yep. My wife was like, you can't do those experiments anymore. Your son's on the other side of the wall. You're going to open some portal and he's going to get sucked into it.
When you did that thing today, when you sent me that picture, all I could remember was I had this one little story. I had this neighbor that was a neighbor from hell, but it was at the apartments in Jacksonville I used to live at. And this neighbor was just a pain in the ass. So I had some Serran Vega D9 speakers. These are this is the same company that made the speakers for the movie Earthquake, right? So I take these D9s. Serran Vega D9s, and I aimed them at the wall. And there was a CD back then called Techmaster PEB, and track 99 was a secret track. And if you put it on that track, it would play at like 8 hertz, 5 hertz, 10 hertz, 12 hertz, below the human hearing range. But if you sit there and have a speaker aiming at you, your insides, your guts are moving around, you know, because of the speaker. And so every day I'd go to work, and I aim my speakers at the wall at my neighbor's, turn that disc on, put it on about the volume on about 3 or 5, and then leave. I came home about the third day. The guy was outside the front just puking his guts out. And I said, what's going on? And he says, I don't know, man. I'm sick as a dog, blah, blah, blah. I think it's because they painted the place. And they got this lead paint. And all this. I'm like, okay. Yeah, that's what it is. He says, man, you need to go because we're moving. I said, really? You're going to move? He says, yeah, man, it's been the last 3 days, man. I've been sick as a dog. And I said, okay, man, sorry to see you go. I'm okay, man, though.
Sure. I'm sorry to hear that. Bapper.
Yeah, he probably listened to this because that son of a bitch.
Yeah. And just so you folks know what he's talking about, I've actually got it right here. It's called an audio spotlight. And we talk about it all the time with Dr. John Hall, the technology that they use in museums to be able to send a message in a directed area. Like, hey, we want this to be 10 feet wide by 10 feet high, you know? Interesting stuff.
Like a mini LRAD almost.
Wild stuff. So I got one. We're going to play and see what we can do with it.
Video that stuff. You need to have your YouTube channel and put those videos out of you goofing off. And we got to have like this little challenge. Like you'll make something, I'll make something.
And nerd off? Have a destructive nerd off? Mike, I can't thank you enough for coming on as always. Tell everybody can go to follow the videos that you put up on YouTube. Of course, other than dudesandbeer.com, shameless self-promotion. Go ahead, my man.
Easiest thing probably to do would be to catch me on Twitter. That's where you get to see all the daily arguments and stuff that we have in the UFO world and various other things that we talk about. Just search for 5x5 News. Search for that on YouTube. It's basically youtube.com/5x5newsUS. Because I lost the 5x5 News channel a long time ago, so I had to add two letters to it. So it's 5x5newsUS behind the youtube.com, or just search for 5x5 News. And if you see something about UFOs or Las Vegas or, you know, anything weird and strange, that's probably going to be my channel.
Absolutely. Well, Mike, once again, thank you as always, my man. Hold the line, and we'll be right with you. You're online, everybody, checking all that out, make sure to stop on by dudesandbeer.com. That's where you can check out all the episodes. That's where you can find all the great content. Make sure to stop on by curiousrealm.com, our new sister site. We will be officially switching monikers to Curious Realm coming up in December. So cannot wait for a whole new world of guests and a whole new world of questions in reality. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. If you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks Bye-bye. For listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.